All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, December 18th, 2017. Boy, this year's gone quick, huh? Well, as I was saying, Monday, December 18th, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 515-604-9386. Our participant code is 419-303. If your cell provider blocks or charges for the call, you can call our backup number, 781-838-3728. If anyone would like to email a question, you could send your questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. So send your questions to questions, plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. And we have fallen behind again, so anybody who can give, we'd appreciate it. If you're not giving $5 a month or more, please consider doing so. Anybody that wants to give a one-time donation, that's appreciated too. So we charge for nothing, and we give everything for free. Matter of fact, there's only one course we charge for, and it's not our course, and that's why we have to charge, and that's for, court access. Anybody who wants to learn that, it's $375 or $350, I forget. But anyway, it's on our right-hand side, jurisdictionary, and it's a very good course. It's well worth every dollar, and they teach you how to do, how to write papers, how to access the courts, how to file, what papers need to be filed. I mean, they teach you everything, and basic simple writing, some strategies, and so on. Of course, it's from a bar lawyer's perspective, so we have to make some adjustments to that. Anybody that is doing that should also be taking our other courses so they can make the proper adjustments to stay within the common law venue here. Okay, next Monday is Christmas, and then after that is New Year's, so we will not be back until January 8th, 2018. So, well, that sounds strange to say 2018, huh? Boy, time is flying. Anyway, this is the first year that we're going to have a Monday off. I don't think we've... Well, Christmas never fell on a Monday since we've been doing this, so obviously, we hadn't had to shut down. Or, and I guess it didn't fall on a Christmas Eve or anything either. So, but in any event, I think this is, well, this is definitely the first two weekends we're ever shutting down in a row. But since, I think, 2012, we've been here every week, and I doubt we missed more than one or two weeks since. So, and again, that would probably be for some holiday purpose or something. Okay, so we won't be here for next Monday, Christmas, and the following Monday, New Year's, but we will return January 8th. We'll continue to send some simple messages or whatever by email. We send out the once-a-week message, and we're also in the middle of the sheriff's project, so we probably will be sending something out there on that. We're going up on a few of the different venues that they have out there to help fund different projects. I think GoFundMe is one of them. I think that's the one I'm working on right now. I'm almost done. I think tomorrow I'll be done with the video. We'll put the video up on YouTube. I think it's going to probably only be a few minutes long, maybe about 3 to 5, probably about 5 minutes. And so it'll give a good pitch for what we're doing, and we'll be using that video for the GoFundMe. We'll use that. Hopefully we've got a Facebook page up. Maybe we'll find that out in a short while. If anybody was able to get up a Facebook page, and we'll try to get our video up on the Facebook, and definitely we'll get it up on our website too. And of course, also we'll get it up on our new website, powerofthecountysheriff.org. Okay, so this coming Christmas, of course, is the Savior's birth. So we're going to read some scriptures that is an appreciation of that. And we're going to look at Luke 2, some verses in Luke 2, and we're going to also look at some verses in John chapter 1. Okay, Luke chapter 2, verse 1. And I'm going to read, probably going to be a little, well, usually we only read between 10 to 20 verses is the max usually. But we're probably going to do about 30 verses tonight. We're going to read 1 through 20 and then 25 through 32. So Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 20 and then 25 through 32. And then we're going to finish it off with John chapter 1, some verses out of this. Okay, and it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee out to the city of Nazareth, unto Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth a firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, an angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone around about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of heavenly hosts, praising God, and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill towards men. And it came to pass, as the angels were gone away from them into heaven, the shepherds said one to another, Let us now go even unto Bethlehem, and see this thing which is come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us. And they came with haste, and found Mary and Joseph and the babe lying in a manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told them concerning this child. And all they that heard it wondered at those things which were told them by the shepherds. But Mary kept all these things, and pondered them in her heart. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen, as it was told unto them. And behold, there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon. And the same man was just and devout, waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Ghost was upon him. And it was revealed unto him by the Holy Ghost that he should not see death before he had seen the Lord Christ. And he came by the Spirit into the temple. And when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him after the custom of the law, then took he him up in his arms and blessed God and said, Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word. For my eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people, a light to lighten the Gentiles, and the glory of thy people Israel. And Joseph and his mother marveled at those things which were spoken of him. And Simeon blessed them, and said unto Mary his mother, Behold, this child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel, and for a sign which shall be spoken against. Okay, we're going to end it with a couple of verses in John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was the life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. There was a man sent forth from God whose name was John. The same came for a witness to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He was not the light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name, which were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word was made flesh, and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John chapter 1, 1 through 14. Okay, let's see. We're really pressing forward on the sheriff's project, and if you're not involved in one way or another, please get involved. And again, everybody should be getting out to the sheriff's page, powerofthecountysheriff.org. Sign up, become a member. Doesn't cost anything. Of course, during the membership sign-up, we do ask for a donation if you can, but it's not a requirement. So if you can give $5 a month or more over there, too, it'd be appreciated. Again, it'd cover the cost of the website, which isn't too much more than what we're already doing here, but it's a few dollars. But the other thing, of course, is the program itself. We're looking for about $80,000. At $60,000, we'll be able to order all the books and start the process and get the mailing going. Actually, a lot less than that, because we only need enough to buy the books. And I'll figure out what those numbers are as we move along. But we also anticipate we're getting 80,000 books instead of just the necessary, what is it, we're doing 20,000, we're doing 20 books per sheriff, about 3,100 sheriffs, so about 68,000 books we're going to need, but we're going to order 80,000. 80,000 it really breaks the price lower at that number for us, and also gives us a big buffer. We want to not only send it to all the sheriffs, but some sheriffs will need more. They'll ask for it. We'll give it to them. We also want to get some out. We want to get some out to definitely to everyone in Congress, and we also want to get a copy, of course, to the President and to Jeff Sessions and some others, and we want to get it to our senators, whichever ones of them and the congressmen that aren't in jail by then. The way things go, and it may be something like that, but any event. And then we'll see who else we'll send it to. If things go well, we'll start maybe even selling it to the general public. But first, of course, we want to make sure we get it to our elected officials. But of course, if we collect enough money, though, we can really order even more. We will, and we will definitely be planning on selling them to the general public for a minimum profit, which would be called really a donation, so that we can continue to pay the bills and keep things going. So again, we do need money, and we need it severely, I'll tell you that. This month was a big sweat to get through, and we're still not finished paying all the bills. We did get a reduction in some bills, hopefully, but then we got an escalation in another bill, you know, back and forth. But nevertheless, we need money. And definitely the Sheriff's Project. Now, we're going to put up for $80,000 up on the GoFundMe programs, and I found three of them. If anybody knows of any others, they can bring them up tonight, or they can get a note out to Jan and another one and whatever the name is, and if possible, the web address. If we get the name, that's all we need. We'll find it through Google. But again, we're going to put out the three, hopefully, and three different FundMe programs. And again, if we get more, we'll get more. We're going to be asking for $80,000. And of course, we've got our website, which will be ticking away, and we'll hopefully get the project going. We had our first meeting of people to bring them together for dialogue, for phone calls, and worked out a dialogue. And it's a potential dialogue. People can change it around. But generally speaking, the dialogue we created is some of the issues or the points we do want to make to the people we're calling. We're going to be phone calling every single member of National Liberty Alliance, which is about 6,400 people. And those who have kind of went to sleep, well, hopefully we'll wake them up, and hopefully they'll start also participating in a literal way, give us an hour a week or more, and of course donate. Donation is the key. I could tell you if we could possibly, if there was any way to get every member to give us $5 a month, we would never have to ask for a dime again. We'd be able to afford this sheriff's programs and more. We'd probably be able to even hire people and get some professional process going in the office. When I say the office, I'm talking about, you know, my office, private office. Well, we'd probably do something simple somewhere. But in any event, if we can get that kind of money, at some point in the future, we hope we will be able to do that because we do expect to continue to advise and inform and educate people from this point onward. Even once we get into the courts and get the committees of safety going and they become committee men and the sheriff become knowledgeable, you know, we've got a lot more to do. We also want to get a program going for education, but we really have to. It's going to be a little while away from now, but we do have presence in every state and most of the counties, and we have enough to be able to really get a program going, hopefully. To get a proper education in school to our children, both on the grammar level and the high school level. And I think maybe we're going to make a case on school, you know. Well, we'll talk about those things later. But the key thing is get a proper education and even into our colleges. When children come out of school, they should be able to go into a court and defend themselves or be able to become a plaintiff if necessary, file a lawsuit, an action at law, or whatever, and every one of them should understand their duty to become a committee man at some point in their life, at least once in their life, and also to fulfill their duty on the jury when called, and they should have the basic knowledge. So anyway, that's what National Liberty Alliance is all about. So that's what National Liberty Alliance will continue doing, and that is to educate. To bring the message out and to educate. Okay, so again, let me remind everybody, get out to powerofthecountysheriff.org, sign up, maybe give $5 a month or more over there or a one-time donation. Get involved. We will be calling you up. If you are not part of the calling list, we will be calling you too and asking you to participate in this campaign for constitutional sheriffs. Matter of fact, I may change the name of that over on this Go, Campaign for Constitutional Sheriffs. I forgot what I put up. Let me see what I put up. I got Constitutional Sheriff Project up on the GoFundMe. Maybe we'll do Campaign for Constitutional Sheriffs. I think that's what we'll do. Then. Let me make a note of that. Sheriffs. Okay. All right. So again, you know, and National Liberty Alliance also, you know, if you're not giving $5 a month or more, please do. We definitely need the funds, and we need it desperately. Let's see, is Jan here? Do we have any announcements? I don't see Jan here tonight. Do we have any announcements, Terry?
None that I know of. I don't get the same thing Jan does, and I see Jan here.
Oh, Jan is here?
Yes.
Oh, I don't see him. Where'd you go, Jan? Let me click on the roles again. He should have popped up to the top.
He has muted his mic, and so I assume that he might be in the kitchen or something.
Right. I didn't see him come on as host. I only see four hosts here: Gerard, yourself, Carl, and me. But okay, all right. Anyway, if anybody has right now, there's two people in the queue. If anyone has an update to give us, jump into the queue right now And as soon as I see your name pop in, I'll presume you're jumping in for that purpose, and I'll unmute you. Other than that, we'll continue to move forward. Let's see, do we... Oh, Jan's calling me on my... What do you call? I'm going to pick him up. Oh, I was going to pick him up. Hey, let me...
He's a little heavy.
Huh?
He's a little heavy for you, so...
And let me see. Jan was trying to call me on Skype, so let me try to call Jan. Should be able to pull this call off while I'm live here at the same time. Yeah, how you doing, Jan? Just to let you know you're coming live over the program. You having problems getting on? Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I don't see you on as a host, so I don't know where you're at. But you could talk here if you want. And
yeah, he's on, but not as a host. You're right.
And I can't hear him, John.
Hold on. Hold on one second. Hold on one second. Is everyone hearing Jan or no?
No.
Not hearing Jan.
Oh, maybe a little way down in Australia, maybe. I don't know. I heard.
Hold on a minute. Hold on a minute, Jan. What were you saying, Gerard?
I said he's like way down in Australia. I heard a little bit of mumbling.
Oh, okay. All right. Maybe we could try to take these later, or we'll take them next on our next, what do you call it? I thought you'd be able to be heard over this through the Skype. Oh, can someone find Jan out there and unmute him?
Okay, I'll try. He's muted himself. He needs to unmute himself. We can't do it.
Okay. Oh, no, why can't we do it?
Because when they mute themselves, you can't undo them. That's just the way it is there.
Yeah, we should be able to unmute them.
I just tried to, and I couldn't do it.
Yeah, me too.
No, I don't think you ever... If they mute themselves, that's it. You're not going to unmute.
How is it... well, let me... You know what I'm going to do? Everybody make sure they're muted. I'm going to unmute everyone for just a moment. Let's see.
Unmute the con.
Let me try to unmute him now. Or Jan, try to unmute yourself now that you've been starset. Can't do it.
Everybody's muted.
I wonder why that is. What's going on with that?
There you go.
I heard Jan.
Yep, you had it for a second. Hold on. Too many people are pressing that button. Leave it alone. You're unmuted. All right. Try over here.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, okay. You've got a tremendous scramble on your some
yeah,
kind of
yeah, but that's because he was coming through me also, but also back away from your mic.
Oh.
Jan. Back your mic away from your mouth. We hear you breathing, but go right ahead.
It's on my headset.
Wow. Boy, you're really coming in loud. Holy mackerel.
Oh, let me tune it down a little.
No, you're good. You're good.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I hear an echo.
I can hear you.
Okay, I have questions if you want them.
Sure.
First question. As it's been so difficult to obtain affidavits for the ongoing Hammond-Bundy case in Nevada, and now that BLM whistleblower Larry Wooten and Washington State Rep Matt Shea have come forward with Larry Wooten's 18-page document detailing the BLM's gross criminality, can the NLA use this revealing document as a general affidavit to start a case, whether multi-state or federal or both?
Well, yeah, we can. Look, any documents we can get, we can use. Remember, you know, as the grand jury, we don't have to prove anything, and we don't really have to have affidavits, but that would be preferable. But a document of that type, you know, that is documenting the case, is there any way to get an affidavit from the person that's documenting that?
I do not know the answer to that.
Okay, well, that would be the question to the person. But, yes, look at...
I have a copy of it.
You do have a copy of that?
I have a copy of the 18-page document. I was going to put it in a newsletter, but it's too long to stick in the newsletter, and I don't have
a URL for it. Yeah, drop it in my Skype.
URL
let me take a look at that. Okay.
It's not notarized either.
Okay, no. Well, drop it in my Skype and let me see what we can do with it. You know, we really have been trying to make contact do some work, and we've had some contact with some people, and they seem to come to meetings. They seem to be interested and disappear, and then they don't deliver. So I don't know what's going on out there, whether people are afraid to give affidavits or what, or maybe that they don't trust us. You know, when we when they were out there in Oregon, we did go out there, Gerard and Tanner, and I think it was just you and Tanner, right, Gerard? And anyway,
I'm afraid they're going to come after us. No.
Oh, okay. Anyway, we did go out there. We had a presence. We wanted to share with them what we were doing and try to help them. But then they had those man on the land people creating the shadow government, having a court in the back room of Denny's, and it really got wacky, and some of the things that was requested of me and so on. But we won't get into those past details. Anyway, they were a real serious problem. And they had they met with these people and were trying to work with them and bring in a lot of stuff. They took them down the wrong road a little bit, but they caught on pretty quick and realized they had to turn away from them, and they did. But we've been trying to make contact, and maybe they're just afraid to deal with anybody who is referring to themselves as the grand jury. We, the people, are the grand jury, and the people have the authority and the right to come together and seek an indictment, no matter how they come together. Ultimately, only 25 people need to come together and do this. Of course, if they have evil intent, then that's a crime, and it's something that could be punished by law. And we know that what these people were doing was not something that should have been done, and it is something that could have been punished by law. Matter of fact, I think some of those people ended up in jail. I'm not sure. I know we had people in Colorado that were maybe connected with these people. Matter of fact, I know they were. And a lot of those people out in Colorado went to jail because they were doing precisely the things that we kept telling them they shouldn't do. And they were trying to do that with us. They were trying to move our hands to do some crazy things, and we wouldn't budge, and we had to cut a group of people off out there. We had the same problem in Florida, and I think there was a third state, I don't know if you remember. But anyway, we want to be very careful to be obedient to the law, follow the procedures and process of the courts, and to act as if they should be courts of justice. Now, if they're not courts of justice, they're committing the crime, not us. And if they're not courts of justice, then, you know, look at our access into that court and the way they deal with us and proceed with us, we'll be a witness and evidence against them. So in the end, in the long run, we will succeed. So, but anyway, maybe that's why they're still afraid to deal with like us. Maybe they just never spent enough time to realize who we are, what we're doing, by what authority we do what we're doing, and we have tremendous amounts of authority. We do nothing without authority. When I say authority, we're talking, it could be statutory authority, lawful statutory authority, the rules of the court, the process of law, the decisions of the United States Supreme Court, the law of the land, okay? The common law procedures, as we understand it through the court of record, Article III courts, all those things we participate with and go forward as if they're going to do the right thing. And if they don't do the right thing, that's fine. They will pay for that at another time. It's only a matter of time. So I'm not sure whether I answered the question. I went on a little too much, but did I get that answer?
I wanted to add something to that.
Well, let Gerard answer, so add something first.
part of what was asked is, can the grand jury do this or that? Listen, using U.S. versus Williams, we know that the grand jury doesn't need a good reason to investigate anything. They can investigate just because they want to know, or just because they suspect, or for whatever reason. However, like that 18-page document, if that fellow that wrote that document is willing to sign an affidavit and swear to it, that's just like he in front of us, you know what I mean, because he's swearing, and that gives us more credibility to investigate a case at that point, because we have a document by a guy that's throwing evidence out and making accusations that the grand jury needs to look into. Plus, we should also be able to subpoena more evidence and witnesses on that particular thing, perhaps. Of course, that's going to take some authority through the court. Would take a sheriff or the president or maybe a special prosecutor that gives us the tools to do those investigations. That's what should happen. Look at U.S. versus Williams says usually under the auspices of a court at arm's length, usually, which means the door is open for unusual stuff, desperate times, desperate actions, that you cannot limit the people when they're defending and protecting their unalienable rights. So yes, we have a lot of power, and of course, you know, they don't like that because you got to start something with no control. What are you, crazy? You know, we need to control this. That's their whole thing: control, control. And that's what's wrong with the system. And it's up to us to put our foot down and look at these cases that are coming out with evidence like this. That's why time is of the essence for us now, because I don't think it's ever been such a perfect time for us to flex our muscles a little bit and push these ideas forward now. Because we know what's wrong. We know their puppet grand juries don't work. We know they're not of the people. We know that the judges taint them and tell them you must rule on the law and all this other baloney, you know, that before they go into a court of law. And that's exactly what's wrong, and that's why people are afraid to go to court, because they see the abuses, you know, the judges controlling and not letting evidence come through and all that. So we have to break through that veil that's there now. I mean, people don't have the confidence in these things. All right, I'll yield. Who just said something?
John, this is Robert.
Hey, Robert.
The biggest issue that we have with getting the affidavits is the people out there feel like we promised them things that we didn't uphold.
Mm-hmm. And do they have a list of what that might be?
Well, like when we were in Portland at the trials there, they heard us say that give us the affidavits and we'll file the papers and get them released, type of thing. And it didn't happen.
We
filed the papers, but nothing came of it. And then you have people like Gavin Syme that convinced them that we're, you know, besides all of that, that we're no better than the phony ones.
Mm-hmm. We did do habeas corpus for all of them. And it wasn't successful. We didn't know whether it would be successful or not, and in most cases it hasn't been. But I think that's going to change in the future, and we know that the case out there is falling apart, and it looks like
it's
going to be a dismissal.
They took it as gospel that we were going to be able to do it. They didn't understand.
Right. Well, I thought we were pretty clear when we spoke with a couple of them that did come to a meeting. I don't want to bring up names, but there was a couple of them that came to meetings, and we tried to be as clear as possible. We also left access to us so that they can get in touch with us. So
they hear what they want to hear, selective hearing,
mm-hmm.
and that's all the right. big issue.
Well, look, the good news is it looks like they're all going to be that case is going to be dismissed. They've all been pretty much released, and I presume that'll even go forward if they dismiss this case, even for those who made a plea. Do you think that's going to go that way? Have you heard anything on that?
Well, I haven't heard anything definitive, but with what the whistleblower brought out, they're talking about arresting the DA in Vegas and all the other prosecutors from the government because they were involved in lies and deceit. In fact, their whole case is based on lie and deceit. And Mr. Wooten brought all that out in that paper that we have.
You know what's interesting is that the FBI is very, very quick. Very quick to arrest and prosecute you if you lied to them. You lied to the FBI, you're going to jail. Okay? Well, I wonder what they're going to do with FBI agents that have been lying to put people in jail. You know?
Well,
all those guys are guilty.
There's a lot going on with there's FBI and DOJ, and them that are being arrested and you know, they're taking them in. And so I expect to hear a lot here very shortly, but they've already got a group of DOJ and FBI that they're, well, they already have their names and they're on the list. Mm-hmm. But Wooten laid it out there to where, well, even Mr. Meyer, the DA from Vegas, he was actually out there at the standoff at the Bundy Ranch and was part of what was going on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's got a conflict of interest even there.
Right.
The only reason that any of this is coming out is because what the Bundys had is what we didn't have when we filed those habeas corpuses. They had an amassing of people from throughout the United States, and the government tried to go after some of these people, and it's backfiring. It was a massive thing overspread out. It was a mass action. And I don't care who you are, common law, grand jury, whatever you call yourself, if the people don't rise up behind you and go into those courts and show their bases, you're going to get nothing. Look, the Dean case went well because they weren't used to seeing more than two people show up in the audience at those courts, and they had numerous people. They had phone calls from all over the United States. That judge panicked and pulled the plug because of that. Now, if they don't understand that, and that didn't happen in the Bundy case, that's because they weren't animated or they were too far, they were too busy with other things. Look, the government's got us distracted. So, needless to say, the long and the short of it is we didn't get the mass action that we should have got in order for this to work. Look, they don't want us in the courts. They don't want this to work. They're going to try to discredit us. And the only thing that's going to cause it to come through is by us insisting on the law. Now, when we file a habeas corpus and they ignore it, that is a violation of due process. That's another case that and we put it in. That's what we're doing. That's what it did, is it revealed their fraud. And that's not over, because it's fraud and they're going to pay. And we, the people, did do a habeas corpus. We did file things. We did send in a case that's pending right now that they don't want in, that they keep trying to kick out and play games with, because it's a hot potato. So we did exactly what we said we were going to do. What did they expect us to do? Go hire an army? That's what they were doing.
Yeah.
They were hiring marshals. Yeah. They're going to get people in Denny's and all. And the trouble was it happened exactly at a point when we were popular, and they came in, and they knew the people, most of the people that weren't educated to this, would just lump us all together, us for them. That's what happened. So the ones that are angry that we didn't do anything, most of them, it's their own fault. Because they didn't understand that this is a mass action and that we did move forward and we are in the court. And my goodness, what's that $400 we paid? It was for those cases. And it's not over yet. But, you know, I mean, we told everybody we don't have a magic bullet. The magic bullet is what Gandhi did and what Martin Luther King did. So if that's the magic bullet, people got to get off of their duffs and get into court. And I understand that some places it's very hard because there wasn't that many people. But any time that you can do that, we understand that one of the biggest successes of NLA is our court watcher system. When people actually show up and take notes, and the affidavit is very powerful, because what it's doing is you're putting a sworn statement in, which is all that's necessary for a prima facie case. They act like they don't know that that's true, but they know. That's why it bothers them. And that's what we should be concentrated on. So that's why we're going affidavit, affidavit, affidavit. And the lawyers go, affidavits don't mean anything. Yeah, to them it doesn't, because who do they swear to? But you know what? That Bible's still up on the judge's desk, you know what I mean, up on the bench. So we still are operating under that law, of justice, under God's law. And they want us to believe that we're not. And that's what's going on. If the people don't...
Well,
you know, that's what you get. But anyway, I'll yield.
With the Bundy trial, I don't see any way they can go forward with it. I mean, it's come out also in the Wooten paper that in Nevada, Nevada State is open grazing. They don't need fences to hold the cattle. The cattle can graze wherever they want to. And if people have property where they don't want cattle, then they have to fence their property off to where the cattle can't get in. Besides that, the Bundys own the water rights. And they've worked that land for so long that they actually own it. And that's also a law where after a certain period of time where they've been grazing the cattle and stuff, the rancher owns that land.
That's part of common law. Hello, right?
Yes. Yep.
Right, well, one of the things we are going to be doing, and we spoke about this, I think it was 2 weeks ago, it might have been last week, but I'm pretty sure it was 2 weeks ago, we reminded everybody to go up to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, and underneath grand jury, highlight grand jury, and come down to docket, click on docket. And towards the bottom of all of these papers that we have here, right before you hit the video on the bottom, you'll see an evidence report. We're going to go forward with the Lavoie-Finnegan case. Anybody who's going to be sitting on that grand jury to put a vote in needs to be looking at all of those documents so that they can, you know, make a proper decision on what they think. And the targets right now is probably going to be shooters number, I think there are five identified by the video we have. And as a matter of fact, they're identified as number 1, 2, 3, 4. I think there was five of them. But we will go after, John Doe number 1, John Doe number 2, 3, 4, and if there's five, five. We're also going to consider going after the governor, and we're also going to consider going after James Comey. He was the FBI director at the time, and there's no way he didn't know. And matter of fact, the pressure was put on him from the governor to Washington, the administration. The administration put the pressure onto Comey. Comey put the pressure onto the individuals who were out there. Lock it down. Let's do what we got to do. That was 1 week before Lavoie-Finnegan was assassinated. And as a matter of fact, just days before his assassination, it might have been one or two, I don't remember, but it was very close to the assassination time, in his last interview, I believe it was his last interview, he talked about that they were ratcheting down, that things weren't the same the way it was. Before there was communications and everybody was relaxed. Now everybody seems tense. There's the pointing of guns, the ratcheting up of the case, the shaking of the sabers. And so on. And all of that, was because something changed. And the change was the letter from the governor to Washington, D.C., to the administration, to the order of to Comey to do something and shut it down. So,
well, actually, the word came straight from the White House to kill.
Well, if we can get that in writing and get that up, but we don't have that in evidence. If we've got any of that in evidence that we can get in evidence, get it to me, and I'll put it up there in evidence so we have that. But anyway, we also have up there the information on 9/11. We'd have to find out who we're going to target on that. Goodness, there's a lot of people to target on that. But that's something we've got to think about. But I think when we come back from after the vacation, like I mentioned earlier, next Monday is Christmas, and the Monday after that is New Year's, so we will not be here for the next two Mondays. We will be back, I believe it's the 8th, Monday the 8th, and at that point in time, we'll probably have an announcement of a date and time for consideration of an indictment in the Lavoie-Finnegan case. And we'd like to go through, and if we do get the indictment, we're going to file it also with Jeff Sessions as well as within our court case. We have filed this evidence in the court. So that evidence is already in the court as evidence. And we'll get a copy of this evidence to the president, to Jeff Sessions. And we will, if we get an indictment, then we'll send that indictment along to them also. And again, ask for some U.S. attorneys. Now, I believe, and this is why I haven't pushed on this, I believe Jeff Sessions, there's something going on This whole thing is a plan between the president and Jeff Sessions. He looks like he's not doing anything, and it appears that he has been quite busy behind the scenes, and he is doing something, but they can't reveal their hand. And I think that's why Jeff Sessions has not connected with us. And that was the time to get this in, and even if he doesn't connect with us right away, I do have the feeling that once things break loose, and they are about to break loose across this nation, everywhere, matter of fact, international, across around the whole world, and if it does work the way that I'm hearing, and I'm sure everybody's hearing the rumble at this point, once that breaks, then I think they're going to make an acknowledgement and accept that indictment if we get one. I can't talk as if we're going to get one because people haven't voted yet. You know?
What about the report that Jeff Sessions was involved with Hillary Clinton in this that Hannity gave on Fox News? He had a line drawn to Jeff Sessions, which puts him right in there at the
time. I'd like to see that. I haven't seen that. Is that just
the
recent one?
It's on YouTube. It's on there.
The one I put up there?
I know
Hannity was beating up Jeff Sessions for not doing things, but I never heard him say that he was involved in a direct way with Hillary Clinton.
He absolutely was when the stuff was going on. He was one of the people who the buck had to stop with. He had to turn a blind eye to it or actually help it.
I think we're going to see where we're going to go soon. I mean, you know, I hear everybody's the enemy, and there's people out there saying I'm the enemy. I mean, they say I'm a bar attorney.
This is on Fox News. And he points the line. If it wasn't true, Jeff Sessions could have sued the pants.
Yeah, but this is one of the videos that I put up. You said there was something in there with Sessions.
I don't know. It was recently when Hannity said, "Let me explain this to you," and he did like what Glenn Beck
on the board, like Glenn Beck.
He did it twice, and one of the times he said, "Look, here's Sessions. Here's what's his name? The other guy here, the special prosecutor." And he drew lines between all of them and explained why he believes that Sessions is at least complicit in it. And look, he may very well be. I don't think that he would be saying that if there wasn't something there. And maybe that's why Donald Trump is using Jeff Sessions, telling him, now you better do this, because now Donald Trump has a lever on Jeff Sessions. Now, that could be a possibility. Why he didn't fire him in the first place, because look, if anybody knows where the skeletons is, it's probably Sessions. Think about it.
Some of these enemies being in the administration, being within some of these agencies, being appointed and also being the problem, it seems to be working out to the benefit and really, you know, building evidence against them in the process by watching them try to keep covering it up. Because they can get evidence that that's true. Now, I don't know what the truth is. I can't comment on this as far as what, Sean said concerning Jeff Sessions until I go back and re-listen. I don't recall. I know he hasn't spoke nicely about Jeff Sessions. What is Jeff Sessions doing? How come he's not, you know? And I understand that. And
well,
we were talking that way, too.
I've seen all the bad about Jeff Sessions from different people, but I also am told that when the military intelligence sat down with Trump and laid out Uranium One and all the stuff, was that Jeff Sessions was in on it too? You know, as far as getting the word
maybe he's innocent in this thing, is participating as really gather evidence and report, and you know, I don't know, but you know, this thing's going to open up eventually. We'll know the truth. It's hard to figure out who's what and where, when, and how. You know,
we won't know the whole truth until it all does come out.
And also, there could have been an agreement for forgiveness for him. Look at we the people are willing to forget anything any elected official and appointed individual has done within reason, of course. We're willing to give him the olive branch and not prosecute anything if they're willing to step up to help save the nation, Okay. Now, that doesn't take away any prosecutions that may come upon them from people who are filing damages against these people for how they've hurt these individuals and put in jail or whatever the case may be. He's going to have to pay for those crimes. We can't stop that. But certainly, if we know that they're subverting and if they change sides and work to get the right thing done, then, of course, we – because, again, if we're going to arrest everyone, I think Washington, D.C. will be a ghost town. Albany will be a ghost town, and every capital of every state will be a ghost town. They'll all be in jail because they're all guilty.
One can only hope, John.
Yeah.
Well, I'm I seen a video this morning the Trump spent the weekend with all the top generals, and that today they sent out 44,000 troops with 10,000 sealed indictments to start making the arrests.
Where did
I'm
you
still
see that?
Waiting for. I received that video concerning that this morning. I didn't send it to your box, but I sent one to Gerard.
Yeah, Gerard or you, so drop one in my box and take a look at it. And I'd like to see what.
I haven't been able to confirm or anything, but.
Right. Well, all of this is just rumbling, is all it is. But we'll look at this. So much rumbling, we know something's going to happen. We just
I do know that he brought all the top generals together, and I do know that was supposed to start just as soon as that Alabama election was done. And I do know that from another source that it should include the arrest of the Clintons and the Bushes.
Well,
hello,
Robert. Uranium Morton, when did it start? How many years ago? A couple of weeks, right? And how are you?
Well, Trump was putting a plan together for 2 years before he stepped into the White House.
Yeah, but Uranium One specifically.
Uranium One, that was, that's been a couple of years.
Well, it goes back at least as far back as the Bundy Ranch and further, and that's
right,
a few years
right. That was 2014. So back in like 2014 when it all began.
Yeah, but they probably were beating them up and abusing the people probably a year or two before that. So it's been going on for a while. We know at least 2014.
Where Hannity drew the line to Sessions was back there that many years ago. Now, if they embedded him way back then, that's...
Well, he was a senator back then, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was a senator, and then he... Yeah, so I don't know if he connected him as a senator or how he connected him.
Well, look, I'm not going to really make any comments on it until I look to see what Hannity had to say about him. I don't recall. I recall him talking and beating up Sessions numerous times, but I never recall him having any evidence. I recall him saying, you know, why isn't he doing something? Why is he sitting on his hands? How come he doesn't get up there and do this? Come on, Jeff. You know, that kind of stuff. But.
Well, this was an accusation that he was in charge and he was at least complicit. This was a specific accusation against Sessions. Now, like you said, they may have Sessions on a short leash now because of that. And Hannity might actually be playing to Trump's hand by revealing it and saying it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't know what's going on.
Take a look. I hear, who do I hear out there, Ali?
Yeah, I'd like to make some comments.
No, you can't.
We got all these juices for. Go ahead, Ollie. Let it roll.
Okay. Hey, for lessons learned, I can tell you one of the main reasons we got no affidavits. Here's the deal. The Bundy case, it was all hands on board. FBI, DOJ, and Bureau of Land Management, Nevada, Oregon, all the way to the DOJ in D.C., okay. Out at Mall here, they had more FBI informants out there than they had cowboys. Okay. The Portland crew, the Portland Patriots, they had them, they infiltrated that group
right from the beginning. And then they infiltrated the group, and also they went on Facebook with very good professional trolls and split that movement on Facebook. Okay. Now, let's go to Las Vegas. Same thing in Las Vegas. And Robert and I knew who some of the culprits were, who some of the trolls were, but we couldn't convince nobody. Okay. They were in tight with everybody. They had everybody totally conned. Now here's the thing, and here's the lesson: to get affidavits out of anywhere, we need MLA members. It always comes back to a committee of safety. We need people in those counties who know what's going on, are activists. Yeah, they're involved in whatever movement or whatever problem they got in that county, because they'll not listen to if anybody that's not from that county, or especially anybody from out of state. Me and Robert talked, we were blue in the face, and we were not from Las Vegas. We are not from that county. It all boiled down to trust that they run when you're making progress in any endeavor. Like we were doing, you get attacked big time from all sides, and your reputation is ruined in a heartbeat. But the lesson is this: in the future, if we run into any problems like that again, now that was a high profile case, and we thought, boy, we can really make some hay with this. However, we were bucking very, very strong evil odds. But the lesson is, in the future, when we need affidavits, we need somebody in that county and somebody knows what's going on and somebody with some pull, because they're not going to listen to anybody else. I yield.
Okay. Thank you, Ollie. All right. Anybody else want to have a final word on this? So we're going to move on.
Well, we even had a couple of people, members in Vegas, but they weren't strong enough to get through either.
Well, look, yeah. You know, even without our assistance, it looks like they've accomplished their goal. They were able to get enough in there and somehow get the reveal to enough to what's going on to enough people. And I think the president had a lot to do with this, with having knowledge and maybe even sending a few words out there and so on. So, but it looks like they're going to throw the case out, and that's good. But we are going to go forward in the beginning of January. We're going to come together to consider indictments in the case of Lavoie Finucane's assassination. And we will have, we probably will bring up again, I mentioned this just a little while ago, but I'll mention it again. The targets are going to be the governor of Oregon. It's going to be Comey. He's the director of the FBI at the time. It's going to be, I remember whether it was four or five shooters that are identified on that video, and they're called shooter number 1, 2, 3, 4, and I think 5, but whatever they were, we're going to go after those individuals. And between now and then, if we can identify anyone else, we're going to put them into the indictment. But bear in mind, we don't have to have everybody. The case would be investigated, and once it goes through, at some point in time, the investigation would take place. They'd find other people. A lot of people would be added to this, and they'll discover who they are. And they'll discover who number 1, 2, 3, and 4, and potentially 5 is. Go ahead, Robert.
Actually, every officer that was out there should be... Should be brought up on charges.
Yeah, you're probably right. Every officer, at least, that pulled the trigger, anyway. But yeah.
Well, every
right.
every one of them, whether they pulled the trigger or not, they were in on it. They were aiding and abetting.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. They didn't step up to become a witness after the fact, at least, and they didn't do
anything to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's agreed. Okay, so let's move on. Let me see where we're going from here. Let me look at my board.
I have several more questions.
Oh, more questions? Go ahead.
Yep. Okay. Seeing that a book's index is a more or less detailed alphabetical listing of names, places, and topics, along with the numbers of the pages on which they are mentioned or discussed, usually included in or constituting the back matter of the book, and that a table of contents is a list, usually found on a page before the start of a written work, of its chapter or section titles with their commencing page numbers. Shouldn't NLA's new sheriff handbook have table of contents printed at the top of its page at the beginning of the book, which lists the chapter headings instead of the word index, which is what appeared on the last draft?
Probably is correct. Table of contents might be correct. I'm looking, let me see, there's some others, because I think we did go off of the constitutional, and also they sent me a couple of other handbooks. Let's see, you know, let's see what we did on the common law handbook. I think we did an index on the common law handbook. Well, actually we didn't, not in front.
The index is normally in the rear, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we called it indexed instead of table of contents?
Looks like it.
Okay, well, we can fix that. It's not out for print yet anyway. Yeah, table of contents would be a better heading for it. And what else on that?
That was it.
Okay. And we'll try to get in the chapters. I don't think we're broken down in chapters per se. Matter of fact, I know we're not, but we are broken down in headings. And we do set the headings, and then we try to put as much information as we can underneath those headings. We have not set up page numbers yet, because what we're doing and what the printer is going to do, the printer will have to set up the page numbers. I know our pages come to something like 80 or 90 pages. The printer's count is about 128, I think, at this point. Actually, it went up. He was looking at 128, but I think we went a little above that, so I don't remember exactly. Maybe it was 128. Yeah, I think it was 128. That's where we ended up. And I'm very leery on cutting anything out. When you get a page out, we're at the max that gives us an even number of pages. If we cut one page out, we're only making it blank. It's not going to change any price. We literally have to cut out four pages, okay? Because the page is actually folded, and on each folded page, in the right side is two pages back and front, and the left side is two pages back and front. So it's a total of four pages. So to save on pages, we have to pull out in numbers of four pages, eight pages, and so on. But, to pull out four pages, just the cost difference just isn't worth it. The value of what the contents is more important at that point. The price is not that big a deal. So, but anyway, we'll work that out and take it from there. Right. Anything else?
Yes. Without due process taking place, can a factual statement be made that LaVoy Finnegan was murdered?
I don't understand the question. Say it again.
Without due process taking place.
Okay, without due process taking place.
Right. Can a factual statement be made that LaVoy Finnegan was murdered?
You mean by the grand jury?
By anybody, I guess.
Well, people could say whatever they want. I say he was murdered. I say he was assassinated. If we, as a grand jury, were going to accuse him, it still has to be proven in a court of law.
Right.
All right. Anything else?
Will there be a link at the NLA website to the must be sheriff's website? I think there was a word or two missing there.
There should be. Let me go take a quick look to make sure. I thought we put something up on the right-hand side, but we do have banners now, so I'll put a banner up. I don't see anything up there at the moment. Hang on a minute. We do have a sheriff's handbook that people can click on. I'm going to put a banner on the front page right under the sheriff's handbook. And so we'll have a direct connection in. I thought we had put something up on the right-hand side of the page, but we haven't. And I'll probably put some kind of a icon on the right-hand side of the page, too. So it shows up on every page, and people won't miss that. Okay, anything else?
Nope, that was it.
Okay, sounds good. All right, is Brent here? I'm looking for Brent. Does anyone see? Oh, Brent's here. I see him right now. Okay, Brent, what I'm going to do is, Brent's coming in on phone, it looks like. Let me mute everyone and go over to Q&A. Okay, so Q&A is open, and anybody that wants to get in there now can get in there. Any questions, comments, or whatever. Brent, are you with us here?
Yes, if you can hear me.
Okay, we can hear you.
Oh, good.
All right, I'm going to pass things over to you, Gerard, for controls. I'll be in and out a little bit, and I'm going to be working in the background. But let me introduce Brent. Brent is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law, and his website is commonlawyer.com. And Brent's going to continue talking with us about the Declaration of Independence. Brent?
Thank you. This is Brent. And the comments I make here may or may not agree with National Liberty Alliance or any person thereof, or my sentences and my conclusions. And I'm, of course, always delighted that the folks at National Liberty Alliance let me say a few words. I enjoy talking about fundamental things. As a matter of fact, there is nothing else. Just fundamental things, and we learn more and more about fundamental things. When I was a teenager, the Green Bay Packers were the champions of the world three times, and Vince Lombardi was the coach. And I know some of you heard me say this before, but I think about it often, and I learned this way back when because he was so well known and people were. Well, he was the rave. How could this fellow who just looked at normal and acted kind of funny, what kind of power did he have over these large men to get them to do what he wanted them to do? And he said every year at training camp, he had them all sit down on the ground and he took a football and he held it up in front of them and he said, "This gentleman is a football." And he said he went over all the fundamentals again. The object of this game is to carry the football over the goal line at your end of the field. That's the object. Don't ever lose sight of that object. That's the fundamental. And we don't want to ever lose sight. We don't want to ever lose sight of the object for our being. Why are we here? Well, we're here for one reason, fundamentally, and that is to make the person who made us look good. It's called glorifying God. And how do you do that? You do it according to his terms, not yours. And what are his terms? His terms are his will. The will of the sovereign is law. The laws of nature are a declaration of 76. The laws of nature and the laws of nature is God. The laws of nature are unwritten in the nature of things, says William Blackstone, and he also then says the laws of nature of God get in the Bible. Lex non scripta, the law unwritten, and lex scripta, the law written. We're in the Declaration of 76. I don't like to call it the Declaration of Independence because it doesn't say that anywhere in the document. It's just a popular name for it. It is not a Declaration of Independence. Not only does it not say it, it isn't. It's a declaration of shifting dependence. And if you read it, you'll see that. It's a declaration of shifting dependence from the King of England, the Emperor of the colonies, shifting dependence from him for protection and provision, and shifting it, as our Declaration of 76 says, to the God of all providence. The supreme judge, it says, of all the world. Resting upon him, they say, for the rectitude. That means the rightness of their intentions. We've been going through this document called the Declaration 76. I believe that's an accurate. Well, it says something different at the very beginning. It doesn't say the Declaration 76, but that's the title's pretty long, frankly, but I like Declaration of 76, and it is our fundamental law. It is our, as Congress puts it, and did put it concerning this document, they decreed that it is our organic law. the first principles we find here. People say, well, Magna Carta is an old document in the year 1250. That's over 800 years ago. That's not our law, and our courts have even said such ridiculous things. That's ridiculous. The first principles of Magna Carta are law. You say, well, we don't have fish weirs. Magna Carta talks about fish weirs, W-E-I-R, because they were in the rivers. And they were impeding navigation. But it isn't the fish weirs that are the important thing. It isn't the fish weirs that are eternal. God's will is eternal, which is the same thing as saying God's law is eternal. Why is it eternal? Because he is. It's his mind, his thoughts, his will. He's from eternity past to eternity present. Yes, and that's what those that drafted this document believed. Half of the men that signed this document were graduates of Bible colleges. Half of them. They had that point of view. And it was always pretty much the same in those days. You may not have their point of view, but don't be ridiculous and say they did. They did. And if we want to know what we're to do today, the first thing we have to discern is, what did they mean by what they said? What did they have in mind when they said these things? And when you discern that, then you can make any transfers you think are proper. Transfers to the present day. Same thing with Magna Carta. Well, what did they mean by what they said when they talked about fish weirs? How does that have anything to do with liberty? Is that part of our common law? What is the first principle here? They apply to fish weirs. Can we apply that first principle in our own day? And of course we can. We sure can. Had to do with navigation. Had to do with the division between admiralty law, maritime law, and common law. We have that same division today. Our Constitution of the United States makes the same division. Because all admiralty jurisdiction is given. Navigable waters in the United States and the shoreline and the navigable waters around the United States are the jurisdiction of the general government in Washington, D.C. If they want to take it, they can. That's a pretty broad jurisdiction. Not as broad as some people think. But anyway, these are the first principles that in Magna Carta, talking about fish weirs, in our Constitution of the United States, the same first principle, and they're talking about navigable waters. Well, that's what they were talking about there in Magna Carta, and the fish weirs were causing a problem with navigation. Well, the reason was, of course, they had little tiny barges in those days, and they did deliver goods down the Thames River and the Avon River, the Tweed River and all those rivers. Well, the Tweed was up in Scotland, I suppose. They wouldn't have had that jurisdiction there at that time. Paragraph 19 of our Declaration of 76 says this. It says that we're upset. That's what it says. We got a bone to pick. That's what it says. It says, for imposing taxes on us without our consent. For, they're mad at King George, for imposing taxes on us without our consent. Remember, Parliament didn't impose taxes on the colonies. That wasn't precisely what was going on. It's still true in England today. The king is a component, is the way to say it, of Parliament. And when Parliament opens in England, just as it did when this was written, this Declaration of 76, the king or the queen, as it may be in the case, as the case may be, they show up at the opening of Parliament and go through the rigmarole of acting like they're doing symbolic things, and the queen today then lends her supposed sovereignty to Parliament, and then Parliament is sovereign. And their sovereignty to make law, and their lawmakers, that's a sovereign power. Their sovereignty, reducing of those members of Parliament, reducing all of the wills of all those members to a single will, their act of sovereignty in doing that is derived. It doesn't come from themselves. It comes from the queen, from the crown. Well, she's queen. in England. She's common law queen, therefore her powers are limited, her authority is limited. She's a limited sovereign. That's an oxymoron, by the way. Only God is sovereign, truly sovereign. But on earth, we have a realm here, the governments of men, we talk about sovereignty, so we call it limited sovereignty. That's what the practitioners and study such things have said for centuries. I understand what they mean. But taxes were imposed by the emperor. And George didn't claim to be king in the colonies. He didn't claim to be king in any of his empire, from India, Pakistan, all around to here. He said, I'm emperor there. My will is law. My wish is their command. That's the law of the city. That's the law of emperorship. That's the law of total government. That's the law of dictatorship. Why did we go to war with England? Because they said the common law, our common law, did not apply. I'm quoting William Blackstone in his first volume. He said, the common law does not apply in our American plantations. And then he goes to all the other parts of the empire around the world and says the same thing. But he says it does apply in England. See, that was their fault. That's the fault of a lot of people, that to think some parcel of real estate where you live is special. The nation Israel makes that claim today, and a lot of people in America make the same claim for the, what they call the state of Israel. There's something special. No, all of God's land is special to him. And what we call our common law, it's been called many things through the centuries, but what we call our common law attaches to this land because we're not the allodial landlord. God is. It's his land. And he gives it to men and divides it among the tribe, tongues, and peoples of the world, as he tells us in his law written, his lex scripta, the Bible. And we are to deal with it upon his terms, to take care of it, not pollute it, not defile it. And if we do defile it, in other words, allow things to go on that had not to go on in mass, we're doing it. We're doing it. Then the result is unavoidable. To put it in the terms of the law written, the land will vomit us out. It will puke us up and out. Well, here's what it says for imposing taxes on us without our consent. The common law has always forbidden levying of taxes without legislative advice and consent. Advice and consent, that's a significant phrase that has found its way into our Constitution of the United States. I have a document. Well, I don't have a document. I have a copy of it, of a land deed from about 900 A.D. in England that uses these words, advice and consent, and says that this is the advice and consent of the Duque. It was written in Latin because Anglo-Saxon hadn't gained, it had just been put to writing not long before that. No, wait a minute. That document was written when King Alfred the Great was 6 years old. No, 8 years old. I'm back, remember what I read. He was 8 years old. Therefore, English had not been put to writing, Anglo-Saxon, at that time, because it didn't happen until he and the Welsh Menasher did it. So it was in Latin, Duque, that means the elders, the dukes. The elders. Advice and consent. It says there that King Alfred the Great's father had to have the advice and consent of the elders, called the Witten Gemot at that time. Witten means white-headed. Gemot means old Anglo-Saxon. It means the meeting of the elders, the old men. And that's why that phrase is in our Constitution. It's an ancient phrase. Common law requires government to follow a certain process in order to tax the people. In the course of this process is due and owing from government. It includes obtaining the taxpayer's consent. It's all part of due process. Because taxation without consent wanders from the course of our common law. Taxation without consent is a violation of the law of the land. And that's another name for our common law. We find in our Constitution of the United States, Article 6. And the law of the land is Magna Carta's phrase. That phrase is taken from Magna Carta, Lex Terra, written in Latin also. Lex Terra, that's taken from Magna Carta, and it means due process. And that's what our common law is. It is due process. It doesn't just have due process. Our common law is a process. It is a way. It is a course, sometimes called the course of the common law. That's what distinguishes the common law from the civil law, the law of the city. The law of the city is not process-oriented. The law of the city is result-oriented. That's why the Jesuits have always said their motto is the ends justifies the means. Why? Well, because the canon law, being the civil law, is result-oriented. The ends justifies the means. We've got to, and that's the way all the world is, pretty near, except the common law countries, like our own. Of course, we're always fighting it, but, I mean, in other places in the world, it's just an axiomatic thing. It's a given. We must conform to what the state wants. No matter what else we do, we got to do that. And the state, of course, gives its commands and statutes and regulations. The due process our Constitution requires for government's exercise of its taxing powers. The due process includes, of course, introduction and passage of tax legislation and to lay and collect taxes. Our Constitution says that the general government has the power to do that. It's due and owing that they go through that process. By the way, amazingly, and this is something people never talk about, I don't know why, somebody needs to be saying something. I find that I say something about it, but it's a voice crying in the wilderness. That all it takes is a simple reading of the Constitution. Go read it yourself. Who has the power to collect taxes? Well, who has the power to lay taxes? Well, our Constitution of the United States says Congress has the power to lay taxes. But it says in the same phrase that Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes. It doesn't say that the executive branch has the power to collect taxes, but yet the executive branch, using that administrative alphabet soup bureaucracy called the IRS, for some reason, I suppose Congress has abdicated their power. Go read it. See for yourself. I don't know how they go about doing it. They've never really done it. Looks to me like they ought to be doing it. Wouldn't that take a lot of trouble out of our lives and theirs and make our country a freer place? Because if Congress had the, if everybody understood Congress to have the power to collect taxes, and Congress abused that power in any way, there'd be a new Congress every 2 years because they kept abusing it. It wouldn't last long. Well, just a thought I thought I'd throw out there. Coming back to this paragraph 19, King George, that's King George III, was king during that time, this time, 1776. Using Parliament, King George III taxed the colonies while barring them both from forming local legislatures and barring them from then giving or withholding consent to taxation, and barred them from sending representatives to Parliament to debate and cast a vote to give or withhold consent to taxation. So to sum up, ownership of property, such as money, is a constitutionally protected right. Let me say that again. Ownership of property, such as money, that's property. That's a constitutionally protected right. Therefore, it is against the law, according to our Constitution, for the government to try to take money from you without due process of law. What is due process of law? They're not to take it from you unless you say it's okay without their consent. You know, our Congress of the United States has our state legislatures, but we think mostly of Congress, and I'll use them as an example. Really, they only have, at common law, two fundamental powers. They have, and these are great powers. Congress has the power under our Constitution, and the common law in our Constitution is a brief common law government, has the power to take your personal property from you. That's powerful. And if they can't get at your money. They'll claim the power to take your house, your car, your antique automobiles, or any automobiles. They take anything to take your property. That's power. You only have three things in this life: life, liberty, and property. And if you don't, all three of those stand and fall together, and to lose one is to lose the other two. To impede one is to impede the other two. If your life is taken, what good is property and liberty? If your liberty is taken, what good is property and life? Throw a man in jail, and this is the way it is. When a man's in jail, he has no enjoyment of his property. He's not allowed to, as a matter of fact. He's not even allowed to call home and tell other people what to do with his property and his business. If he gets caught, he'll suffer the consequences. That's because he lost his liberty. And when you lose your liberty, it's just the way it is. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying if you lose your liberty, you lose your property, and you lose your life. Men that are in prison are forgotten men. The world, as it were, the world stops spinning for them, and they get off, and the world goes on without them. They're forgotten. Even if people come to see them, they're still forgotten. They're not part of the world anymore. That's why imprisonment is such an ugly, godless thing. Besides that, it's against the trust set on by God, and it impedes a man to scatter abroad across the land as God commands. And, by the way, it keeps a man, being in prison keeps a man from being fruitful. I knew a fellow in prison once. He married a wife who was younger than him by 15, 18 years, something like that. And she was getting up toward 40, and she wanted to have a child. And he wanted her to, and he wanted to have one. And he was there for 4.5 years, and he knew that by the time he got out, she probably, well, she'd had less chance of having a baby. And she didn't want to wait because she wanted a baby. She wanted to marry somebody or divorce him so she could have one. That was ugly. And he wasn't a dangerous man. Prisons impede the productivity and the progress that God commands of men. Namely, in this case, back to fundamentals. The most fundamental command given to man, the most fundamental command of God given to man, correct my soul, is to be fruitful, multiply, and scatter out across the land. That's what he wants. Why? Because it's his land, and he wants it populated. That's why. Because if it's not populated, no one will take care of it. And if there is no private ownership of land, no one will take care of it. He wants it taken care of. Well, to sum up, getting back to that, taxation is government's taking of property. Consequently, common law demands that government, in laying and collecting taxes, follow the law of the land. That is due process. That means to get constitutional consent. Due process, by the way, Amendment 5 of our Constitution requires it, and Amendment 14. Due process. You say, well, what is due process? It is the process that is due and owing to all concerned. It is the course that must be followed. You see, common law is a course to be followed. It is not, we've got to achieve the result the government says. No, it is a following of a course. And if you follow the course that the law demands in seeking justice and seeking what is right, then the result is reliable. As our common law says, one of the maxims of our common law, good process, reliable result. Bad process, unreliable result. I learned that one a long time ago, and I see it is overarching and governs everything because due process is our common law. It is the most fundamental feature of our law. Never forget it. It is not what. Our common law does not command what is to be done. It doesn't order men around. Not fundamentally, no. It doesn't say what should be done. Our common law demands how things are to be done. It stresses the how, not the what. The law of the city stresses the what. The government has commanded you to do this. The government has commanded you not to do that. Always trying to manipulate the future. Manipulate the future behavior of men. That's what legislation is. That's the command of government, is legislation. in its attempt to control the future behaviors of men. What does our common law do? Fundamentally now, what our common law does, it says, well, there's no problem until there's a problem. Somebody wrongs you, you're offended, you go to court. And watch this. You don't look forward. You ask the jury to look back and tell everyone what happened, to decide the facts. See, our common law is fundamentally opposite, every point, to the law of the city. It is the wisdom of the Creator. It's his law. It's his way of looking at things. See, Brent, the common law is not in the Bible. No, that's not in the Bible. The common law is the Bible. Everything in it is about the course of process. And over and over and over again in the Old Testament, God says that he describes his law, his will, as his derek in the Hebrew text, which means road or way. And Jesus Christ said in the New Testament, he didn't say, I'm the law. He didn't say, I'm the command. He said, I'm the way. John 14:6, I am the way. What is the way in the New Testament? Same thing. Greek word, odos, it means road, just like derek in the Old Testament. I am the way. I am the course to follow. That's why the stressing is put on, follow me. That's the whole idea. And if you concentrate on the course called due process, if you concentrate on that, you'll get justice. But if you concentrate on the result is going to be something some mere mortal set out there. It's not going to happen. You're just going to get the will of men. That's the difference. One more paragraph. Paragraph 24, depriving us, they're upset at George III. Why? For depriving us, in many cases, of the benefits of trial by jury. Trial by jury. There's another fundamental. Notice they don't say a lot about trial by jury. Why? Well, because everybody knew. It's had a common experience concerning trial by jury. Trial by jury was their inheritance. Never forget, trial by jury only exists in the English-speaking world. It has never existed anywhere else. Of course, the English tongue has changed quite a bit. It used to be called Anglo-Saxon. It used to be called, it was a Germanic tongue. But they had trial by jury way back, we're going back 1,500 years ago. We know they had it on the continent of Europe. In the Nordic, among the Nordic tribes, and the Germanic tribes, and the Scandinavian tribes, and the Celtic tribes. Why? Well, we look at history, we see it, and it came from there to England. Why did they have it? We don't know exactly how they got it, but we do see the links. And as I like to say, they get lost in the fog of antiquity, but there is a link between the number 12 and all of the numbers 12 in the law written of God, 12 disciples, the 12 tribes, the 12 stones, the 144,000, 12 times 12. It goes on and on. 12 is important, very important to the government of God. You see the number 12, look around and you'll find the government of God, but I add this, the government of God among men. In other words, government delegated to men is characterized in the Bible by the number 12. Why do we have a 12-man jury? Ask a lawyer. He won't have a clue. Ask a judge. Neither will he. Ask a law professor at the law school. They won't know. But I know because of its connection to the Maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is. We have evidence that by 1,500 years ago, the Bible was a part and familiar to those tribes living in the north of the continent of Europe, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. The Jutes are the old name for the Danish people, and the Celts did live there also. The Romans lumped them all up into one group and called them the Teutonic tribes. Well, they had this number 12 among them, and we know the Bible was among them because King Alfred the Great translated, along with Asher, his Welsh scribe, translated the writings of Boethius. He was a king, Clovis, king of the Saxons on the continent just before the Roman legions left, about 450 AD, before they left Britain. And in those writings, we discover his familiarity with the Bible, as we do also in the writing, the saga called Beowulf. The number 12 can be connected. That's the only way anyone has ever been able to connect the number 12 to our common law. I'm not saying that that's utterly conclusive, but no other answer emerges. Well, Rhode Island. Maybe somebody listening is from Rhode Island. Rhode Island loathed the law of the city so much back in 1776, and it was so strong that Rhode Island conducted her admiralty courts. Admiralty is a kind of a law of the city jurisdiction, a martial law. They conducted their admiralty courts using the jury. Now, they didn't have permission to do that, but they said, doggone it, if they're going to try to extend admiralty jurisdiction into these colonies, and that's what the Declaration of 76 said they did, okay, we can play that game. We're going to impanel the jury in our admiralty courts, because that's a feature of our common law. That's the center of our common law, to have juries decide the facts of the case and judge the law. And so they did that. You see how versatile the common law is? But consequently, in Rhode Island during those days, conviction of merchants was rare. They hardly ever were convicted of crimes because they weren't dependent upon some lone admiralty judge. They were dependent upon the jury. Now, the colony of Massachusetts, their hatred for the law of the city, the civil law, the Code of Justinian, admiralty law, administrative law, canon law, their hatred was so strong that Massachusetts refused to establish equity courts until the year 1873, almost 100 years. They had no equity courts. They didn't recognize equity. Equity came out of the church courts, the Roman courts that were in England. The priests' courts, and they used the canon law of Rome. That's what, and they called it equity. So that the word bothered these folk in New England. They weren't going to have anything to do with it. They were settled, of course, by Puritans, you see, that fled to America. And the Puritans in England that didn't flee ended up going to war with the king, took over Parliament, went to war with the king, and whooped him terminally. And Parliament has had this privilege I talked about a while ago ever since of receiving delegated sovereignty from the crown and then being sovereign and making law. We inherited all those ideas, you see. And when our founders talked about republicanism, they weren't talking about majority rule. They were talking about the idea that the Civil War in England had established of Parliament becoming sovereign and the legislative body having the power of lawmaking. That wasn't strictly our common law. They had trouble getting back to it. But the legislative body is not sovereign in America, not in our states and not in our general government. The legislative body, Congress, we call them, are co-equal with the executive branch and the judicial branch. Neither one of those, none of those three branches, trumps the other. They're in constant, never-ending tension. I call it a continual Mexican standoff. That's what our government is. That is the fundamental of common law government. Don't let any of them be in charge. Just keep them all at odds with one another as much as possible so they'll leave us alone. They'll fight with each other. That's the idea. James Madison said it just that way. Well, they wanted trial by jury. And experience shows that without a true and impartial common law jury, a government will control the outcome of cases. I say that again and apply it to the Bundys out in Las Vegas. Listen to what these words say. Experience shows that without a true and impartial common law jury, government will control the outcome of cases. In other words, government will replace its will for personal freedom. To put it in Lysander Spooner's words, he said, you've got two choices when you have criminal trials. You'll either have trial by the government or trial by the people, trial by jury. Which would you rather? Try you, the government or the jury? the jury is proof of our distrust of men. We do not trust, namely, as Justice Scalia said, that lone employee of the state called the judge. And he said, the only thing that stands between you and a lone employee of the state when you're accused of a crime is the jury. Consider that. Justice Scalia, he understood that much. Trial by jury becomes trial by government. If the government controls the outcome of cases, the British extended civil law's admiralty jurisdiction among the colonists, extended it off the high seas, onto the piers, into the warehouses, and then on into the homes. They did it. They did it by putting soldiers in the home. Soldiers are under martial law. When a soldier walks into a home, he brings the law of his uniform with him, not to mention the eyes and ears of the government. That's how they spied on people. They quartered soldiers in their homes so they'd have an idea all the time what was going on. The government has other ways of doing that now. We must be vigilant to watch for the new technology. Very important to our liberties. Unlawful searches and seizures comes with admiralty law because there is no freedom from, there is no warrant requirement in admiralty law. I used to live on a ship. I can tell you for a fact, when the old man, that's the captain, when he says, I want that man's locker searched, there's not much you can say about it. The master at arms or the boys with the guns come down, they search your locker. That's the law of the sea. Because the law of the sea is it's a dictatorship. The captain of a ship is the most powerful. The powers of a captain of a ship at sea are beyond what most people consider. And that's right that he has that power at sea. But he is not to extend that power onto the piers, into the warehouses, and down the streets, and on into the country. There must be a division. And that was, the colonists were experiencing the time when England was saying, no, there's no division. You're just all under admiralty law. The common law doesn't apply. Well, denying these rights, the king lowered enforcement costs of tax collection, and he benefited England's central bank interest holders, which included himself, King George III, and many members of Parliament. That benefited them, and it benefited the trading arm of that Bank of London, that central bank, called the East India Trade Monopoly, and all the offshoot monopolies that came with it. King George even set up boards of bureaucrats with unconstitutional powers to extend the jurisdiction of admiralty courts, not only for collecting taxes, but also for the trial of all cases arising in the colonies here in the United States. And I take that from the Journal of the Continental Congress, 1774, pages 63 through 73. Volume 1, pages 63 through 73. That's what he did. He extended admiralty jurisdiction into the colonies. In our day, that would be as if IRS agents, and these IRS agents are administrative law arm, that's an administrative law arm, a civil law of the city, not a common law arm of the executive branch of government. That's what the IRS is. It would be as though the IRS sat as judges without any jury over all felony, misdemeanor, tort, and contract cases in your state courts. That's what they were experiencing. Just think of that. Government bureaucrats, like IRS agents, just saying, well, I'm an IRS agent. I've got the power to put on a black robe and sit in judgment over this matter without a jury. In fact, the IRS now extends its power to enforce and judge all matters concerning, for example, watch this, this health care bill, Obamacare. The IRS has been delegated the responsibility of administering that legislation. Don't think it can't happen here just like it happened then. It's happening as I speak. I'll end with this. A quote. I'm looking here who said it. Oh, it was me. I said it. Here it is. Our Declaration of 76 teaches, above all things, that the powers that be are creative without end in devising schemes to deny trial by jury. Why? Because the jury threatens those ever-present government defendants out to abuse their power through terror, domination, jailing, and plundering. Because, I'll repeat that, because the jury threatens those ever-present government dependents out to abuse their power through terror, domination, jailing, and plundering. And if you've ever felt the club, the whip, the blackjack, the gun of the powers that be, you'll not only know this in your head, you'll know it by experience. And once you know it by experience, and increasingly men are knowing that in America, things may change. I just saw a video, I'll end with this, and maybe somebody sent it to me on the internet, and apparently it's going around. I hadn't heard about it. This cop in Phoenix that murdered this young father as he was lying on the floor obeying his orders, and he had his web, his the camera on his not webcam, but his camera on his uniform, recorded the whole stinking filthy mess. Murdered him in cold blood. I saw it. It shocked my conscience to the point that I was talking to a friend about it. I didn't know how to describe it. I said, I can't even. And then the jury, in that case, acquitted him. That's what's going on in the United States. You know, we're talking about Finnegan. We're talking about the Bundys. And those are high visibility cases. But this stuff is going on all day, every day. The police have turned out not to be our friends. Well, John, are you there? No, Gerard, maybe.
Yeah, maybe Gerard fell asleep or he didn't unmute his mic.
Oh, I was afraid.
Which one is it?
I was afraid I was talking to myself. I'm glad you came back.
No. All right, well, let me... are you back, Gerard?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. Oh, what did you do, fall asleep on us?
Oh, I went to fill up my glass.
Oh, okay.
Water, not warm either.
All right, I'll mute myself. You got it.
So we'll move to the questions and answers then. Thank you, Brett. Informative session there. Anybody has any questions for Brent, also get in the queue. And we'll, if we can catch him before he leaves, he'll answer them to the best of his ability. Okay, I have California Fred in the queue, and I will open him up. He is in the line. Or no, I guess it's Eric. California is next somehow.
Okay. Thanks. How you doing?
Good.
All right.
All right. Yeah, so I just want to make a point about the Wooten document. If folks are going to start reading it, I heard that this Wooten fella, he's been lauded for bringing out this material, being a whistleblower, bringing out these facts. But from what I understand, he makes a remark about how the Patriots there, they did engage in some criminality. However, I also heard that this criminality that he's talking about is not really criminal behavior, because if you consider the intent of what these Patriots were doing, they had been told by the BLM, and I believe the FBI, that they could come and collect the cattle because the cattle were going to be released that the government was holding illegally. And so this is why they went on to that land that Wooten is saying that was part of their criminal behavior. So I just wanted people to understand that when he does talk of Patriots being engaging in criminal behavior, if you consider the intent of why the Patriots were there, then it's not criminal in the least. I just wanted to bring that up. And then Robert had mentioned, I believe it was Robert Thurston, I called him, supposedly Jeff Sessions had told all federal judges recently that they had to follow the Constitution, and I was wondering if y'all had heard about this, and because it sounds like a big deal to me, but maybe it's not that big of a deal at all. Did y'all hear about this?
Yeah, go ahead.
I heard something to that effect, but I heard it came down from Donald Trump, but maybe through Jeff Sessions, that he told them that they need to adhere to the Constitution because that's part of his agenda. And that's just about the time that Judge Navarro started backing up. So, I mean, I don't know. I didn't actually see. I mean, I don't think there's any documentation for that that I've seen. I don't know, but it was all over the internet. Or at
okay.
least all over from my sources, but.
Do you think that would mean anything to us here at the NLA and what we're trying to do?
Oh, absolutely, because that's what we're complaining about, the same thing. You know, we sent Donald Trump and his team paperwork. They've seen our memorandums of law, and that's one of the charges that we make. So, you know, it's logical that he would order that, that somebody would order that. And it should come from Sessions, really. And the president has an obligation too, I think, to uphold the Constitution when he knows that there's wrongdoing being done, and Session being the Attorney General is the right guy to deliver that message to the judges, because, you know, he has the power to bring a grand jury in and have them indicted when they don't. So they're giving them a warning. I guess the next step will be that the grand juries will come in and indict these judges if they don't follow the Constitution. So basically, I think that was the shot across the bow. You know, under common law, you always give warning and notice, and usually it's three times, that number three. And so, you know, this was part of that, I do believe. I do believe they're following the Constitution and the common law. And so, you know, these judges that don't understand that, they better figure it out really quickly, because it looks like, you know, their feet are going to be held to the fire. At least that's what I'm hoping. I don't know how deep, you know, their power goes to actually enforce that. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I just wanted to say that I thought it was great, the question that John posed about what happens when the FBI lies, because when we lie to them, we go to prison. And by the way, why is that even a thing? Where do they get the power to send people to prison because you lie to the FBI? I can't imagine that I would do anything but lie to the FBI. That's ridiculous. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to make a comment, admonition for people to be careful. To lie to a police officer or government agent, FBI, has been a felony for a long time, been a crime. Just one case that I wanted to mention to show how dangerous this is. That's why we have the right to remain silent. You just don't talk to these people, because they'll accuse you of, if they don't accuse you of lying, they'll accuse you of telling them the truth in order to mislead them. That has happened, and people have gone to jail for that. But this man, I don't remember his name, famous director, and he's the one that directed and produced the Die Hard series of movies. Now, I never saw any of the Die Hard series, so I really don't know what I'm talking about, but I've heard of them. This guy's famous. He's a famous movie guy, and he has a ranch in Wyoming or someplace, and he was involved in a business deal. It's rough and tumble, the movie business is, apparently. And he had hired a private investigator to investigate a fellow he was doing business with because he was trying to steal his money. And it was about midnight, and his phone rang, and he answered it. And the fellow on the other end of the line says, without introducing himself, didn't say anything, he just said, "Did you hire a private investigator to investigate so-and-so? And he said, "No." Didn't think it was any of his business, whoever the guy was, you know. Well, it turned out it was an FBI agent. And he went to prison for lying to a federal officer. And I had a client that happened to once, an IRS agent, that walked into his place of business. He had a shack, a man cave built in back on his farm. And he was back there, had a refrigerator back there and an office. And IRS shows up and throws a couple of tax returns down in front of him, just comes right there. They don't introduce themselves, just throw the tax returns down and said, "Do you agree with everything on these tax returns?" And he said in his colloquial way, "Well, I reckon." And he was indicted for lying to IRS agents because they said there were lies on the tax return. His accountant had done them. He didn't know what to say. He didn't even, he was just kind of shocked. Of course, that's what they wanted to do. they wanted to surprise him and just see what if they could catch him lying to him. Well, he didn't really lie. He just was trying to be friendly. If you know they're a government agent, you're better just not say anything. Not even you don't even want to say, I'm not going to talk. That's the way it's getting. Now, that's not to make people paranoid. I live like that, but I'm not paranoid. I don't worry about it. I just, like it says in the Bible, Jesus Christ says, if people aren't following your will, your law, or God's law, and you know it, that they're habitually in violation, living contrary to the fundamental will of God, you treat them as a heathen and a tax collector. Well, let's put that in modern words. We treat them as a heathen and an IRS agent. What do you do with an IRS agent? I don't know anybody that gets real warm and snuggly with them. When you see them, you usually go the other way, or you take a wide berth around them. You hope they don't notice you. Well, the same way with a lot of cops. You hope they don't notice you. These guys carry guns and have a monopoly on force and violence. And so it's best, and I'd be paranoid, you just stay away from those kind of people, like my mother used to tell me. She still says it to me, by the way. Well, she tries to use herself as an example. I just don't pay attention to those kind of people, and I stay away from them. Trying to encourage me to do that. Well, I don't think that's such bad advice now that I'm older. I see what she was saying. By the way, that's good Bible. That's what the Bible says.
Back to you, yeah. Jordan.
Yeah,
I remember you saying that you in Bible study, weren't you? You cut a wide swath around these folks. I amend my previous statement by saying I won't lie to them. I will just not say anything. And I appreciate that. And then just a couple of more. The thing about Trump putting down the order to Sessions and Sessions putting it out. With all this rumbling about these indictments and these sting operations that hopefully Sessions and Trump are involved in, part of the whole discourse about these unseen, unfelt, unheard rumblings of the good guys fighting the bad guys is that Trump, he understands that you can't get justice in our courts. Our justice system is completely corrupt. Why they're doing things behind the scenes. So, you know, to have them say that they need to follow the Constitution, that might be a shot across the bow, and I really hope that's what's going on. And then one more thing. Did you hear this thing about here right just down the highway from me that a terroristic plot was thwarted here at the airport, our airport, the busiest airport in the world. Supposedly they caught these bombs in time, but hardly anyone's talking about it. But I heard, and I didn't see it, but I heard that Trump tweeted about it. You know anything about that? Did you hear anything about that?
No, you're talking about Atlanta?
Yeah, Atlanta.
No, I haven't. Gerard, do you hear anything about it?
Yeah, I heard that something came out from Trump or his team that averted an attack. I also I heard something else that Putin thanked Trump because some information that he got through Trump avoided an attack in Russia. So I don't know if that's related. They were very close. You know, I heard them within a day of each other or 2 days of each other. But I didn't actually read or go chasing after the article. That's something that maybe somebody can do. I don't know.
Okay. All right, gentlemen, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. I yield.
Okay, thanks. Okay, next questioner. Jim from New York, go ahead.
How you doing out there?
Good. What's shaking in Jim land?
Well, we're putz and puttering up here. I made some calls this week to try and get you guys on a radio interview, and I got you on one if you want to accept the scheduled date that they got. So I just wanted to make that as an announcement. And I got some...
What's the date on that, Jim?
What was that?
What date do they want to offer us in the time?
27th, but I don't even know who it is, so I don't know, you know.
Well, we'll talk to anyone.
It's Twister Radio. It's called the Common Sense Show. So, you know, it's not Dave Hodges.
Right. This is one on our list that we were on before?
Yeah, I do believe it is. Yeah.
Okay, so the 27th, what time are they looking?
It should be like about 10:06 a.m.
So 10 a.m.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's 2 days after Christmas, December 27th.
Yep, it's a Wednesday.
Wednesday. All right, I'm good with that. How about you, Gerard? How long? An hour, 2 hours, a half hour, what?
Well, basically, he just replied back and said he's very interested, and he scheduled a date tentatively, and that he wants to...
Right, you can confirm that. Gerard, you'd be able to make it?
Oh, I don't know. It's the middle of my work day, and I don't know what's going to happen on the 27th.
Right, well, Gerard may or may not make it. I'll be there. Just, ask him how much time... and how he wants to approach it. We've been on his program. If it's on the list that I gave you, we've been on his program before, so we'll just kind of update him and then take questions if he wants or whatever he wants to do. Okay?
Well, if you want, I'll push it towards you. I pushed it to Jan, and I thought he would kind of schedule it through you. But then you asked about announcements, so...
if you want to handle... Jan's kind of busy, so if you can handle it. If not, then we'll just overburden Jan.
Yeah, sure. No, it's fine. I'll keep my breast on it in case something happens.
All right. Confirm it and get all the information. Make sure you have the contact information if they're going to Skype us in or phone us in, or do we phone in, or what do we do? Just get those details. Make some good notes on it so for future references we have all that info if we go back on their program again.
Right. And the other announcement I wanted to make is to the general populace out there that if they had any radio shows that they listen to or that they know of, that we would be, that would be interested in hearing us, and they should just, I'd say the email. Maybe they could go to the recent comment section and just put the info in there, just one line. That's all something for me to get a hold of.
Well, you know what we may do? Maybe we'll create a page just called Radio. And on that radio page, put the information and all of the radio interviews that we've had in the past on there. And put out the word for people if they are interested in, contacting a talk radio in their neighborhood and... see if they're interested in us talking with us. They can give them the website, and if they do seem interested, then you can make second contact, and then we can do the scheduling. But we'll have to set up a form, or maybe just an email link. That'd probably be the best thing. I'll do an email link. We'll have it forwarded to you, Jim, we'd ask that information for. Where the radio is, contact information, and the contact of the individual will put it, sending you their phone number or something. You can contact them, get more details, then make contact with the radio station and find out what time availabilities they can offer us.
Well, that'll work, too. I just thought maybe if, people were doing it and they just started putting it on, just grab it and go on the comments. It'll show up on the recent one. I'll see it. I'll take it out of there, and then it can just disappear down the line there.
Right. Well, doing it there is kind of a little problem because you don't want people to be putting their phone numbers, and you do want to contact that person,
I'm just looking for, websites or names, something that I can Google search. I'm looking for just one line.
Well, that, too. They can do that on there if they want. So that'd be good.
We'll create
a radio page where people can actually go. It'll have a comment place so they can make comments on that, and you'll catch that. I'll set up the page, and then you can go out and look at it and tell me what we're missing.
Yeah, because I think our we should seed where we're going to bear fruit. And I think these radio stations that are out in the Midwest, and, there's a couple of them, and they're key to the Bundy's cause, and they're on all the rest of this, so... That's right there. Plus, their sheriffs are becoming more aware. So, I think that out there, if they let me know where they are, we can get them set up,
Right.
Well, we got lots of people listening. That's why I figured it'd be nice and quick and easy. Maybe they'd start dropping them in there now, and then I can start giving them a line, you know, or dropping them a line and see if we can set something up. So that's the whole idea. I mean, we got to stop from being being shut out, you know. We have to be more intuitive, you know, and go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Reach out if the sheriff's campaign is going to work. We got to make it work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to change the name to Campaign for Constitutional Sheriffs. We're going to leave everything on the website pretty much the way it is, but as far as putting out the video and talking with people on the outside, so to speak, and even making a reference to it from our website, and even making a reference to it on the sheriff's website, I think we're going to change it to Campaign for Constitutional Sheriffs.
Okay. It's too bad we couldn't get a nice little acronym for that. You know, like CARE or something like that. FREE.
Uh-huh.
You ever heard of them acronyms for some websites?
Yeah, but we want to get the message out, though, in this case. You know, I think an acronym won't help that much where the real message is Campaign for Constitutional Sheriffs. Or Constitutional Sheriff Project is what we have right now. So.
Yes. Okay, well, I'll be thinking of an acronym. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So other than that, no, I just wanted to reach out. You know, many oars move the boat, you know. So if everybody drops me a line and we get 50 interviews instead of 5, it'll be a big difference.
Right.
So I'm reaching out to the populace there to send it in. However they get it in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We can make it around. We're all connected. All right, I yield.
Thank you, Jim. Victim. California Fred.
Well, thank you, Gerard. I've got a bunch of questions. I can tie up the whole meeting.
Well, I'll try not to let you do that.
Oh, I know, but what's got me going right now is Trump has all these massive tax cuts, and I'm wondering, what can we do when California and New York and Florida, their state taxes start hitting us, and you can no longer deduct them from your federal taxes, and they're going to stick
Stop
out.
Stop paying them.
Stick out like a sore thumb. What
Stop
can we,
paying them.
What can we file?
File nothing.
Well, like in California, they have a city income tax, a state income tax, and then they have workman's compensation, unemployment insurance, Social Security, and federal withholding. I mean, by the time you get your paycheck, and then they want to charge you at the bank to cash it.
You know what? The cities, well, I can't really speak for every place, but here in New York, it's been my experience, as far as income taxes is concerned, any state income tax is, they're frightened to go collect because they know. They depend on the IRS to do all the collections and pressing, and they just try to use fear-mongering, but they just go on and on and on. And I know I had problems with the unemployment tax stuff, you know, those people. And really, they never done anything. They just got a big mouth, and they try to scare you and so on. But, you know, you got to be careful when you ignore those powers that be, because you really don't know what they're going to do. There's nothing more dangerous than ignorance in action, you know.
Well, that's what's going on, is a lot of people are losing their homes to taxes on water or taxes on power, something they've forgotten or didn't even know about.
Well, you know, I'm working right now in the background on the video for, and like I said, it's going to be 5 minutes or less, the video for Campaign for the constitutional sheriffs, and I happen to be on the page, you know, if, and let me just read this because this may will answer all, this will answer all of our problems, really. If sheriffs can receive a proper education, it would empower them to enforce the true law of the land. Number one, sheriffs would stop all unconstitutional warrants. Two, sheriffs would stop all IRS liens, thereby closing down their debtors' prisons. Three, sheriffs would stop all non-judicial mortgage home foreclosures. Four, which means they'd stop all mortgage foreclosures because they can't do it with due process. Same thing with the next one. Sheriffs would stop all non-judicial tax foreclosures. Five, sheriffs would prevent incarceration without indictment and trial by jury. Six, sheriffs would prevent, I should probably add something in there in courts of justice. Six, sheriffs would prevent federal SWAT teams from breaking down our doors in the middle of the night and terrorizing our families. Seven, sheriffs would prevent the enforcement of all unconstitutional statutes. Eight, sheriffs would empower the people by enforcing our Bill of Rights. Now, right there is all the power. If the sheriffs had that power, we wouldn't have much to worry about, would we?
Well, yeah, you would, because you still haven't endowed the sheriffs with the power. Now, they said...
No. The law and history already does that. That's okay. What this book is all about.
I'm trying to tell you, though. Okay, the sheriffs are in every courtroom. They're in every... They're in the prisons and jails, everything. But the sheriffs should instruct the jury of their fully informed jury. They should instruct them, not the damn judges.
Well, clearly, neither of them should instruct them, because both of them are elected officials, and that's not their duty. It's the duty of the people to instruct the people. And that's why we do the administrations. We need to take on that job. Okay. But the key here, even to get the sheriff to instruct them, it still gets back to educating the sheriff. And the sheriff needs to be educated enough that he can develop a backbone, which he has no fears and no problems exercising the true law of the land and telling any of these people that they can go to Hades, you know?
Okay, so what are the constitutional requirements to be a sheriff?
Know the Constitution and be willing to enforce it.
Well, a lot of these places require them to be a law enforcement, code enforcement officer for 20 years.
Well, again, that's what we're trying to show them. That's what the book, have you read the book yet?
Well, no, but I'm trying to tell you, like we had an election for sheriff over here in Santa Cruz about 6 years ago, no, like 12 years ago, but a guy named Quigley, he was supposed to be a constitutionalist, he ran.
The guy that wrote a book, but go ahead.
Well, they jumped out and changed the law. You had to have something like 12 or 15 years in prior code enforcement, you know, being...
Well, they can't do that. He could have battled that. He could have battled that. They can't do that, number one.
He could have battled a lot of things. He was in the court every time he turned around. They were making new laws.
Yeah, well, look it. Here's what we need, okay? And this is what National Liberty Alliance is working on. We're not just working on the judicial end of things. We're working on the political end of things. That's what the Committees of Safety is all about. And to morph those people right back into the committeeman process, who are the people that put these people on the ballot. You see, that's what people who don't understand where these people come from. These people come from the powers that be, the deep state, you know, laying out the rules across the entire nation. You look at Democrats, you can, we'll approve this one and this one, and that's it. And Republicans, we're going to approve this one. So it's the criminal on the right or the criminal on the left that we're always getting. And the committeemen at this point in time think they vote for all this stuff, but the whole thing is a con job. They never vote for anything. They make it appear as if they vote for them. I've seen it as much right down here in Poughkeepsie, where they'll take the vote and they do a paper vote. They haven't put it in the box, and they continue the meeting while two guys take it in the back room and count them. Okay? Now go tell me what that's all about. You know they set the stage. The other thing is maybe they don't have enough votes, and all of a sudden you got someone showing up the door with all these proxy votes. Congress won't even allow proxy votes. You know, you can't have proxy votes. So, you know, they got all these games going on. Well, if we the people can take back the committeeman process, which we intend on doing, First, we have to take the courts back. Then we're going to take the committee man process back through the committees of safety and using the courts in order to leverage that in, to pry that door open and get them in there. But you see, once the people are in there and we get rid of this control of committees, you know, look at 50, you can vote in a chairman anytime you want. The chairman doesn't have any more powers than anyone else. The chairman doesn't decide what comes up to discussion or not. He may decide what may come first, second, or third. He may negotiate that out with a few people and then run the meeting. But everybody gets a turn and everybody gets to be heard. And if you don't like the chairman, take a vote. Over 50%, 51% gets rid of them. That's it. You vote a new guy in at that point. You can't allow these people to take control of these committees and just order everyone around. We all have the same power, the same authority, the same vote. And when you get in there, you know, the purpose of the committee is to hear out the potential candidate. And once you hear out the potential candidate, now you start asking them questions. Tell me about the First Amendment. Tell me about the Fifth Amendment. What do you know about due process and the court of law? And they don't know nothing. Well, why don't you leave, figure this stuff out, you go take a course over here, learn this stuff, and then come back and talk to us. Because you can't run for office and be of any position, power, or authority if you don't know the Constitution. You're going to lift up your hand and swear to obey and defend the Constitution for the United States of America. Well, how can you do that if you don't know it? And you see, if we start getting statesmen in there, people who know the Constitution, and we bring those people in there and we walk their papers, these other guys won't get in because they can't walk their own papers. And even no matter how much they want to become that position, it takes a lot. To run on a county level, they're going to need quite a few signatures. And few people will go out and do that. I mean, people who really, really care and want to make a difference, I've seen them do it. I've seen the Liberty people doing it. But generally speaking, these other clowns, they're not going to do it. And we don't want them to. But look at, if they want to walk their own papers and they think they can get on the ballot that way, fine. If they do get on the ballot, that's good. Let the people decide. And the committee men, when they lay out the positions of the people running for office, when that person is laid up on the site to see what this person is all about, we put down the point. Now, he's not interested in the Constitution. If you want to go visit his site, here he is, but we didn't take a 500-word essay to post him up here on our site. You see, this is how we got to get involved. If the people expect to be ignorant and free, as Jefferson said, they expect what never was and never will be. And we have to become, every single person should be taught in school that at some point in their life, at least for one term, a two-year term, they need to become a committee man. That's what they need to do, okay? And men, you know, every man and every woman. And then everybody also should be taught in schools that they have to respond when they're called to jury duty. This is important. We're not going to waste your time. We're not going to keep you there for 6 months and take away your income and inability to live and all this other stuff and control you. It's going to be a minimum amount of time, within reason, of course. A long case is a long case. But, we have to really also give these people more money. You can't take a person out of a job where they can't be paid while they're not working and they have a family to support, and then they got to come up for, what, 30 bucks or 50 bucks, whatever it is, a day. It's not enough for people to live on. So we need to put our money there instead of, you take some money away from the judges, take some money away from the prosecutors. We don't like them anyway, right? But look it. Got to take control of the political process. You do that by taking control of the committee man process. Got to take control of the judicial process. We do that by taking control of the jury, you know, orientating the jury and bringing the jury together. We need to take control of these little nisi prius courts and all of these code enforcement officers running around and all this other crap and the IRS and out of control agencies, federal agencies, state agencies, whatever agencies, and we do that by educating our sheriff. And then we educate ourselves and our children all the way. And when we're all educated and we're all getting that proper education, we're all going to know, and ain't nobody going to be able to walk on our rights. Okay, and so the whole thing is a package, and that's what we got to do.
I got an idea.
Okay.
Now these cockroaches, they hide the numbers, they hide in the dark. What I think we ought to do is do a FOIA on all employees of the government, the chief of police, the chief of the fire department, every city council member, the mayor, the governor, what they all get paid, every cockroach in the whole damn pile.
Well, the committee men can post that, and we can start challenging some of these things. If the committee men feel it's necessary, we can start challenging this and demand that the legislators responsible for that salary setting fix this problem. We demand it.
Examples in California. The state of California is one of the most corrupt states in the land. Do you know that the state of California, a lot of people will property to the state. So here's, I know of four different properties that have a six-bedroom, four-bedroom, or a two-bedroom home on a bluff, a cliff, overlooking the ocean. $1 million property on 2 or 3 acres of land, each of these places. And what do they do with them? They allow a state employee to have that place rent-free as part of his job. They take teachers that cannot afford, they don't pay them the pay that they need to live in a high-income area. Like, let's say, down south in Monterey or Carmel. So they have to live outside the area in a cheap area so they can drive to schools where their kids are driving Porsches and Lamborghinis because they can't afford a house.
Yeah, but, you know, I appreciate what we're saying, and that's what needs to be done on the grassroots level. I mean, you know, we can't do that from a national level, but we can encourage, and again, this is the job of the Committee of Safety. The Committee of Safety, again, is to morph back into what they were meant to be, and that's the committeemen. And the committeemen, it is up to the committeemen to come together so many times a year and work on these problems and situations and make a decision on who they're going to support to put on that ballot, because those are the people that put the people up on the ballot. Right now, they don't really get a decision. They think they do, but they don't. But nevertheless, and they even think they're elected. And I assure you, I doubt there's a committee man in all of the United States that's elected. I doubt it. But I do know many of the states we looked into, we haven't found a state yet where committee men are elected. But they make them appear to be elected. And they're very sneaky and they're very good with that. But nevertheless, okay, the bottom line is that's the job of the people. The people can do all these things. And again, what are we doing with the committees of safety? We're getting them to work with the sheriff to begin with, create an alliance with him, get his support, get his signature and his name onto the paperwork of the process of the committees of safety, then start visiting, inviting him or his deputies to come to the meetings, and then start visiting all of these different elected officials and groups, you know, and start bringing things in order, you know, get the town and the village people and the village people, and the cities and so on, and bring these people, you know, back under the control. And basically, you do that by rallying around the Constitution. That's how you do that. You rally around. And we've written all this up. We've got all this information written up on how to create a committee, a committee of safety. But anyway, let me pass this back to Gerard.
Okay.
I have trouble napping. You keep passing it back to me.
Yeah, I was expecting snoring.
Okay. Well, we got less than a half hour left, and we still have four people to get through. So I'm going to go ahead and move on, Fred. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry if I hogged the system.
That's okay. No, you exercised John, and that was good. Okay, Felicia from Florida. How you doing, Felicia?
Fine. How are you gentlemen doing today?
Good.
I have a question. Well, first of all, I've listened to the Common Sense Show, so I listen to that a lot. But I wonder if you guys are familiar with what just happened here in Florida. A 94-year-old woman was evicted from assisted living, and they sent, like, 6 or 7 local cops. They locked her up. She only weighed like 100 pounds. Her arms are bruised and everything. And they evicted her for being behind 3 months. But from what I've seen on the news, she said she tried to pay and they refused it. But she spent her time in jail. And it made worldwide news, too. The video was so disturbing. I mean, like the officers cam recorded everything, and you know, it was. I couldn't believe that they would actually evict a 94-year-old woman. And this happened 6 miles from me, and it's right here at the same courthouse that they evicted me from, and I can almost guarantee it was the same judge that evicted me. And so I'm looking at it like, you know, they was gonna try to do me like that. That's why they sent all them cops to my house. But it was just inhumane how they did this lady. It's just sad. Did you guys hear about that?
No, I actually didn't. But even if you had to evict a 94-year-old lady, why would you bruise her up? I mean, even if she was,
yeah.
I mean, come on, 110-pound 94-year-old lady, it doesn't make sense. You know?
Yeah, her ankles, and they had her ankles chained and her arms chained, and she's sitting there like, all my stuff is gone.
Wow.
And I think it was a dispute with the landlord because they wouldn't fix something in her house or something like that. But I just couldn't believe to see the local town cops do that to that 94-year-old lady. That's somebody's mother.
And then they got cameras on. You'd think they would know better when they got cameras on. I mean, you know, how arrogant or ignorant must they be to do that in front of a camera? And that only says to me that they're trying to make an example out of people because they have an agenda to fulfill.
94 years old. 94. It's like, how can you treat the elderly like that? And some people are saying she had dementia or something.
Well, she might have, but still. I don't know. I mean, all these agencies, I mean, why is she being evicted? Because she couldn't pay or what? You think that at that point there, you know, we talk about all this health care and the safety net of Social Security and you know, years ago, a lot of these problems the churches took care of because they went out and they would get somebody like that and people would take them in, you know, and now the government's supposed to do it. The churches aren't, whether the government's doing it, or so they say they're doing it, but they're not doing a good job of it.
Yeah, it was so widespread that somebody actually got her out and put her in a hotel up the street from me. It's like, wow, I wish I could do more, but, you know, it's just sad. But I don't want to hold a line up. Go ahead.
Look, they send armies of people out for child abuse and child protective services. They also have adult protective services. And instead of protecting, they're assaulting. These are safety nets that are supposed to be in place. Look, that woman should have never been in there past the time. If they knew they had a case for evicting her and they were right, they should have worked to get her out of there so that the cop would never really have to show up and do that. You know, I mean, come on. You know, they ought to be able to do things in a humane way. You know, and I don't know what her particular situation was. I mean, look, if somebody's living somewhere and they can't afford to pay or they haven't been paying, they can't expect to live rent-free. You know, so you can't tell me there's no charitable organizations out there that cover this stuff, you know?
Yeah. Okay, well, I stand mute. I just wanted to let you guys see if you guys ever heard about it.
Yeah, well, that's unfortunate, and it breaks my heart. And look at you, you know, like you said, they would have done you the same way if you didn't have the fortitude and forethought to do what you did. You know?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I wasn't doing it. I've never been a jail. I don't want a record, so I wouldn't. I wasn't. You know. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Okay. Okay. Bye-bye. Next. Victim is Crystal from Connecticut. Go ahead, Crystal.
It's Stephanie.
We put her to sleep. Crystal! Going once, going twice. Okay, just get back in, Crystal. If you can, before we're done, I'm bringing the next caller in. Just get back in the queue.
Jeremiah. All right. Hey, what's up? It's Jeremiah here in Northern California. You know about me already. Everybody, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Real quick question. I have other questions after this, but couldn't you guys come up with a jury verdict based on the National Liberty Alliance jury pool? All the members in National Liberty Alliance, there's got to be enough of them to actually create a verdict regarding this lady who was evicted from her home, this 93-year-old lady. Like, I think that she was probably denied due process because when it comes to evictions, you need to get a court order and have a judge authorize it. And that's kind of interesting because the taking of property, especially when it comes to the government being involved, has specific qualifications that it needs to pass. It needs to actually meet a specific standard or else it's not lawful. So my question, I guess, is couldn't we come up with a jury verdict to help this elderly person who was deprived of her property?
Well, when you say a jury verdict, you're talking about an indictment, because certainly we can't come up with a petty jury verdict, because that has to come out of her local area from her local people, you know, a jury of the woman's peers or against the cops that did it. I don't know the
right. Well,
we could do
well, the interesting thing,
if they don't recognize it, it does no good. You know,
okay.
That's
right.
That needs a public outcry so that they can get some enforcement. You know, what's the particulars of the case? I don't know.
Well, bear in mind, the 25 or the grand jury, whichever you want to call it, they've got the power and the authority to make phone calls, write letters, and let them know, hey, what are you doing here? If there's something illegal going on here, by the way, guys, we're going to look into potential indictments. But again, you know, we don't have that clout yet until we get recognition someplace. We've got to get that leverage. We've got to get that critical mass. We've got to get that recognition from someone. Particularly, we need to get it from Jeff Sessions or whoever's going to take his place if he's going to be replaced. But we need to get it from him because they need to send us some U.S. attorneys, and that's a recognition right there. And then at that point, we got leverage and clout.
Okay, thanks. Let me ask you another question. Has NLA ever come up with a verdict at all with regard to any jury or trial of the facts? Any trial of the facts?
No, we've come up with indictments, but we haven't come up with from a trial. We're not a trial jury.
So you guys don't form common law like juries? Help forming the formula?
Well, yeah, we want to orientate them and put them, give them the power of the people, the power to decide both law and the facts. So they have to have the power of nullification. They have to understand the commitment that they've taken an oath to God, ultimately a vow to God to be righteous, to do the right thing. Come with a sense of honor,
right.
Justice, and consider mercy at the end of the day. All of those things. But, you know, you can't have a trial jury without a trial in a court of justice, and we don't have the ability to set up a court of justice. I mean, that's what some of those other guys were doing that we cut away from us, and that's what they did out there, trying to create a system where they're going to have a trial jury in the back room of Denny's. And get a conviction,
yeah.
And I guess they were going to lock them up in their basements or something. I don't know what they were planning. They were going after judges.
Well, a trial jury, first of all, trying the facts is nothing more than testing.
No. It, we could never do it here at this point. The best we could do is work with the grand juries, get control, get recognition, get some indictments. Once that happens, then we start to exercise and move the grand juries in each of the counties across the United States. The grand jury administrator, shall I say, which will take control because we'll set our case in the judiciary. They cannot be trusted. You can't give
the keys to
the hen house.
Let me say something. The Fifth Amendment talks about public danger, and it talks about the indictment, right? And it basically talks about you can't be, you have to have due process unless you're indicted or whatever, but except in times of public danger. So this whole thing about indictments doesn't make sense when we're in a time of public danger. We've got people usurping power, and they want to sit there and try to usurp the power. That's a time of public danger. Why do we need to indict anybody?
Okay, look it. First of all, we don't have we're not in the kind of an environment, political, socially, or anything, to be able to go that next step that you're talking about. Nor do we have the real knowledge or the authority yet to be able to run. You know, the only way we'd be able to do it is to get a sheriff to run it or a coroner to run it. Because that's happened in history, but you need a magistrate. You need someone who's going to be the traffic cop. It has to be someone with authority. It is a problem that we have, but you see, the power and the authority will come when we get recognized with an indictment. That's when it's going to come. That's the tipping scale, and that's when we're going to fill up the courts. And they're not going to be able to stop us at that point. And we're going to make a case, a very clear-cut case, that you can't give the keys to the hen house to the fox. And we're going to show, look at, the judges protect the prosecutors can protect the judges. There's a wink, a nod, and a handshake. And
let me interrupt.
Hold on.
All right.
Nobody ever gets... any kind of an indictment to these people. I mean, they're like untouchables. So they control all the lawyers. They're the minions of the New World Order. They keep them in
opinion.
Order. And no, it's a fact. They control the lawyers. The bar lawyers are the minions of the New World Order, no matter how you put it. The minions of the deep state, if you want to call
it. All right, that's an opinion.
They're all out there.
Is there any exceptions? Is there any exceptions to this indictment rule that you guys refer to?
What do you mean?
But the grand jury.
Are there any exceptions to the indictment?
The grand jury doesn't decide guilt or innocence. They just decide if there's enough evidence for a pettit jury to decide guilt or innocence. They don't have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a much looser thing. The only thing, you know, the yes or no is whether or not there's enough evidence to say that a crime has been committed. That's all. That's what the grand jury does.
But he wants to take it to the next step, Gerard.
Because the grand jury doesn't.
I'm saying there's no need for an indictment.
Yeah,
Gerard,
what he's talking about, you correct me if I'm wrong, Jeremiah, what he's talking about, and I'm going to use a little bit of humor here, he wants to take this to the back room of Denny's and have a trial. That's what he wants to do. He doesn't want to get into the... am I wrong in what you're saying? Am I wrong?
A little bit, yeah.
Explain then, because I don't understand a little bit. Explain.
Well, because
want to be a little bit in the background.
Yeah, where do you want to? You want to bypass the grand jury indictment? You can't bypass the indictment. Number one, the indictment is first part of the. Wait a second.
I'm asking. All right,
hold on. The Constitution makes it crystal clear. The first part of this process is the indictment. That's what you got to get. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So after the indictment, it's clear. The United States versus Williams. He laid it out very clearly that we operate normally under the auspices of the court. But hey, look at the key part to that is if you can't, you can operate outside in the streets or wherever you can to bring, an indictment in. And when sheriffs understand that, they got the most power because they can walk right into the court, go to the clerk and say, I need a room. Okay, you can use this room down here. I need a conference room. He can go in the streets and start pulling people off the streets if he wants. I want to take your time for 10 minutes. You got 10 minutes? Whatever the case may be. He can pull 25 people in on his. He can make phone calls. He can do what he wants. Get a bunch of people into the room. Get his indictment. Fill out the paper. Serve it to the clerk, and then go get the arrest warrant from the judge. And there's nothing anyone can do about it. He could do that right now and get away with it. We can't. We don't have that power and authority in any way of being recognized. Although it should be. Any 25 people can come together and do something like this. We, of course, you got to watch out for radicals, and those radicals will have to be put in jail like they have been. We've seen it already happen. Okay. We've seen these people do this in the back rooms of Denny's, so to speak, and they went out and used it to exercise liens on judges, and then they sell the liens and they monetize them. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Yes.
So what is it that you want to do? You want to bypass the grand jury,
no.
Go right to the jury process. Are you going to put them in handcuffs and bring them to this place? And where are you going to have the court, and who's going to
run?
I have an answer for
you. Actually, that process is actually, we need to work that out. And you know what? It's just going to depend on what we did in the past. But my main point is this.
Well, that,
is
what,
that
what we're doing is what we've done in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, look,
it's always been in court.
If you look to the Constitution, what we're going to see is that the Fifth Amendment actually says what we have done in the past is that if there was ever a time of public danger, we create an exception to the rule of an indictment. We don't need indictments.
Gerard, you need to get closer to the mic. We can hardly hear you.
No wonder I can't break through.
You're a voice in the wilderness here. You can barely be heard.
You don't know how true that is. Okay, sorry. Times of public endangerment, what determines that is whether or not the court is open. If the court can't open, that's why they had that judge that sat there and he was guarded, because if the courts were closed because of it was too dangerous for the bailiffs and everybody else to get there and hold court, well, then you're in time of public danger. That's the measuring stick. As long as that court is open, you can't do martial law stuff. You can't put it. We understand in a police action, when the police have to take control of anarchy, then they bypass the grand jury. They got to throw you in jail because you're breaking the
grand
jury.
So where can I find the standard that you're talking about there, where it says what the time of public danger is?
As long as the court's open, then you can't declare martial law. Brent has a Brent.
So the standard is the court being open? The courthouse?
That's right.
Right. So in other words, you great point. Oh, my God, that's an excellent point. Check it out, you guys. Your court... Our court right here on this call is a common law court. So as long as the state or federal government doesn't try to
shut down
this court, yes it is. Yes
no,
it is.
No. First of all, you can't. How are you going to run a court? Explain how you're going to set this up. Tell me how you're going to set this up. Are we going to go on indict or something?
No, the idea is you have to follow the procedure of the 9th and 10th Amendment.
Okay, so how are we going to get a prosecutor to come into the process? Are we going to create our own prosecutor? And who are we going to put in here as traffic cop, as a magistrate? Are we going to find someone who truly is a magistrate? And
yes.
What building are we going to go to? And how are we going to enforce subpoenas? And how are we going to make the accused come in and sit there and defend themselves? How are we going to do all that?
There's a couple of remedies. One of them is to actually offer incentives to public officers that are already holding positions within the de facto. The other one is to inquire.
You think you're going to get someone to step outside the system and work with you on this kind of a situation?
It depends.
There is no depending about it. This is ludicrous, to be honest with you.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, let's let another caller ask a question. Thanks for taking my questions. You guys have a good night.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Rod.
Yeah. What do we got here? Next, we have, 435. There's no name.
Hi, you got me there?
Are you there?
Hi. Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, this is Steve Peters out of Price, Utah.
How you doing?
I'm good. How you guys doing? Nice to see you. A little while back, I was pretty involved with the NFA, and I got myself in a little bit of some trouble when I went up to the federal courthouse and checked to see if our paperwork had gotten in there. That was when I started noticing a lot of heat as far as the man coming down on my back. You know, and since then, I've had to kind of back off. But I got some court cases in that was challenging the jurisdiction. And the jurisdiction of the police, the arresting officers. And after the cases were ran through the system, they didn't recognize the paperwork and the stuff that I put in. They unified the police, the corporate police, with the sheriff's department.
Really?
So now we've got three or four little cities around Price. There's Helper, there's Wellington, there's East Carbon. They all have their own police forces, and they just unified the whole bunch within the sheriff's department.
Well, that's not fair.
I guess,
that's that's not a bad thing, because really the sheriff is the one with the authority, not the local police force. Look, they don't have a constitutional authority. They're just guards hired by the city council. The constitutional lawful police force is the sheriff. Now, if you had a constitutional sheriff, that's very good, because he can control those little police forces under the Constitution. You know, we would love to push, but look, the sheriff is over them anyway. As he's the chief law enforcement official in the county anyway. So whether they're united, right, right. Say they're united, guess what? When the sheriff has to step in because something's not constitutional, he trumps the feds, he trumps everybody on that scene. So in a
I understand that. Oh, but it's just the fact that how
they're not uniting them for a good reason. They're probably abusing the term. You know, they got a sheriff that's their guy. I don't know what's going on, but if you got a good sheriff, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because then at least he can keep track of them and make sure they're not doing unconstitutional things.
Well, he's on the sides of the courts, you know, with the judges. I've found this out.
Yeah, well, a lot of these sheriffs are taken to the FBI school in Quantico when they are elected, and they're trained and brainwashed. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just went through the court here last week, as a matter of fact, on a jurisdiction matter, and it's a municipal court, a justice court, and I told him, you know, you don't have the jurisdiction you need to be even processing this complaint against me. And they just went right ahead with it, and I turned in the paperwork, said that you don't got jurisdiction over me, and I'm not coming to the court case. I turned that paperwork in, and I didn't go. And then they arrested me, and they took me to jail.
Yeah, but
I had to post bail to get out.
But you should have removed it to the federal court for cause. That, then they would have listened, because they would have had a stay there with a federal case. Look, they cannot decide whether or not they have jurisdiction, because they got a conflict. You can't. That's a complaint that whose relief cannot be granted by them, because you're complaining to the wrongdoers. They can't offer you. They can't offer you justice, because they're the ones doing the injustice.
That's right.
The only thing they can do is say yes, we don't have jurisdiction, but they can't say yes, we do. It has to be proven.
Well, I mean, they issued a warrant for my arrest, so that's saying that they believe they have jurisdiction.
That doesn't give them jurisdiction. That just proves that they have power. There's nothing as frightful as ignorance in action. And, of course, you can turn around and sue every officer and everybody that took part in that, because they're liable for that violation of your due process. And that's what it's about.
That's where I'm wanting to take this, is up to the federal courthouse.
Because you can't, look, at the state will just run you around for 10 years and you'll be broken. You're not going to get any relief from them. They don't have the authority to grant it.
Yeah.
So
I know this. I mean, I understand the jurisdiction thing, but they're not the ones that are not understanding it. They don't know, you know, I mean, I haven't given the information on, you know, how judges can go to jail for 10 years for, you know, operating under color of law.
Yeah, well, what you have to really understand here is that you can't give the judge any authority, okay? When you go into the court and you challenge his authority, you challenge his jurisdiction, you're challenging his authority. And when you challenge his jurisdiction and you lay out the fact, don't ask him what his jurisdiction is. Tell him what his jurisdiction is. He's administrative, and he's Prius Court. Define it. And then let him know that you don't belong here. You have not decided to participate. Now he's going to think you're crazy, maybe, because look, most of these town judges and city judges and village judges haven't even gone to any kind of a law school. Some of them have, but most of them haven't. And they go to a 6-day judge lesson, a course after they're elected. And then they follow the lead of the prosecutor, and that's all they know. They don't know nothing else, but that's fine. Once you've given them the knowledge that they don't have the jurisdiction over you, and you object to everything in the court, he's going to ignore you. He's going to say, come back, and he's going to say this or that, make some rulings. And then that's when you leave and you move it into the federal court for course. Now, how to do that is another thing altogether, and that's what you have to learn.
That's
what I'm trying to have to learn.
I think they do a lot more training than 6 days. They have their state magistrates association. They tell these guys, get the people to contract. They tell them that, you know, if the person is collecting this or that benefit, they got jurisdiction over them anyway. These judges are brainwashed when they come in. They give them the thing, and then if they have any questions, there's a phone call goes out. He'll go in the chamber. He's got another guy that's always sitting there ready to help him. And what they do is they give them, you know, the point A, point B. They talk about people that do common law, how you deal with people with common law. They give them a lot of tools to keep them in the parameters where they want them. You know, you can't.
Right. Well, they deny me common law jurisdiction.
That's state
magistrate. Just flat out denied it.
What's that?
And they just denied me the common law jurisdiction. I mean, I invoked it and invoked it and said
and
I.
And they're gonna because they don't even know what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where you move it to the federal court.
You got it. Look it. You give them only one chance, and that's it. Look it. We have learned through the School of Hard Knocks. We've had cases that we help people with, and literally, this is no exaggeration, going back and forth to court for 6 months. Okay, and in some case, the one guy up on the far western corner of our state here, up by Niagara Falls, a guy up there, he does a lot of this on his own, and he's been in a court, literally in a case for a year, going back and forth, fighting with the judge, never getting anywhere, and trying to push them to go forward and try this guy and put him in jail and all this other stuff. And again, we've seen this, we've done it, and we've learned, and we come to realize this is how to deal with these people. You take it to where it belongs. You see, once you challenge jurisdiction, it now becomes, and they don't have the jurisdiction, and you tell them you're not getting due process, that's a Fifth Amendment violation, and that they're acting under the color of law, that's U.S. codes, that you can pull in on that. Once you put that, you only have to go to court once, to see that and to be able to write it up on paper and move it into and you don't even have to pay at this point because you already have an index docket number, case number, or something in that court. So you're going to use that number and you leave an open number on the cover sheet for the new number of the federal case. But they have to give you that because you're moving it from one court to another court, and they're not going to charge you nothing for it. Okay, so you don't have to pay the $400. But you do have to know how to fill the paperwork out. You have to know the rules of the court. All this stuff is available and simple. But the process and how to paperwork, what the paperwork looks like, that's a little bit difficult. But again, this is where you go and you get your education through a course like Jurisdictionary. We offer Jurisdictionary through our site. You can buy it through if you do go to the youth, get it. You click our site because we'll get $50 for it. It's the only course that you pay for that we give. Take a constitutional course. Take our civics course. Those both are free. Get involved. Read our paperwork. See how to write papers. See how to create the forms and see how to file it.
Yeah.
And then you can go.
I've done the constitutional course.
Okay. Then you can go. When you put all this stuff together, then you can go and start kicking butt because, now the federal judge has got to hear this case. He doesn't have a choice in the matter, and he wants to get rid of this. And it's been our experience that these judges don't like lawyers from the state level. That's been our experience, anyway.
The judge down here that ran over the case, he closed the case. You know, he sentenced me. I didn't go to sentencing, and I just kind of missed that court date. Actually, I just messed up on the date.
So you're kind of a wanted man right now.
No. I went into court just a couple days ago, and he told me, well, he says, why weren't you here? And I said, I got to the swore you told me to be here on the 12th, and, you know, I'm here. It is the 12th, and I'm here, you know. But he said, no, you're supposed to have been here the 7th. And I said, oh, well, that's a misunderstanding, I take it. And anyway, he said, well, this is what we're going to do. And it was a speeding ticket, and he just charged me the minimum amount, the minimum amount he had to charge for the speeding ticket.
Yeah, the state surcharge or whatever.
Yeah, but then I done, you know, half a day in jail too, you know, and got roughed up pretty much with that ordeal. But I want to, you know, teach these guys a lesson that they don't have the jurisdiction, and for them to know that, you know, for them to get through their heads that they just can't go treating people the way they're treating people.
Well, look at there. You also got to be very careful when you're in court and you're speaking in the wrong half on behalf of yourself. because these judges are trained to suck you into their jurisdiction and contract with you, and you don't even know they're doing it. We clearly stated what we were doing and everything. And as I'm getting up, and I said, look, it's already defaulted, this, that. The judge says to me, what do you want me to do? I said, well, you should dismiss it. I said the wrong thing. I don't want him to do anything. He had no power to do anything. So when I said, I want you to dismiss it, I gave him the power to rule against me.
Right.
At that point, I contracted with him. And there,
yeah,
I believe that they're teaching him this. It was his last. He threw that ball out. He threw that curveball, and I swung at it. What I should have said is, well, I don't expect you to do anything because you can't grant me relief. That's what I should have said, right? So you got to be very careful.
Well, you require him to do something.
Right. It's much better to just I object because it's not my wish, and it'll be in the paperwork. That's all.
That's pretty much what I told him. But this guy, he just closed the case and it right then and there. So do I still have the recourse of taking it to federal court then or no?
Sure. Why not?
Right. Because it's fraud.
If he closed the case with that.
It doesn't matter anything. He never had authority. He violated your due process rights. He violated and by taking jurisdiction, which he didn't have, he violated you there. Okay. He acted under the color of law because he wore his little cape, his black suit cape, and came out with a gavel and started making law and telling you what you're going to do and what everyone else is going to do. Goodness, you got all kinds of stuff here.
Yeah. I understand all that.
That's why we grow up with those cartoons like Power Rangers. They put their cape on and they become superheroes.
Yeah, that's about it.
They watched us from when we're little kids. Don't mess with the man in the cape.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm just going to have to hit the website real hard and learn about what I got to do to get this thing into federal court.
Yeah, it's never too late, never too late. There's no such thing as statute of limitations when it comes to a court case. Now, it could be a real old case and everyone could be dead or forget what even happened. And, of course, your case falls apart and you don't have a case. So circumstances and facts are going to shut your case down or build your case back up. Have you taken the jurisdictionary course?
No, I have not.
Okay, if you want to write papers to get into the federal court, you need to take the jurisdictionary course unless you have someone that could teach you how to do this process. And then, of course, we can show you some layouts and different things, but you gotta understand how it works. I've learned to copy a lot of stuff by watching other people's papers, how they did it. But I don't use their words because their words are statutory. My words are law. And so, but I look at the process, I see what they do, on my cases, even when I file a state case, I list out all of the authorities within my entire paper there, okay? And then every one of those authorities that I'm listing, okay, I make, first of all, I cover the authorities in the paperwork, okay? But then I put a front page and I collect all my authorities that I use throughout my paperwork and I create a page for that, a table of contents, whatever you want to call it. And, and I follow through, I've seen other lawyers file papers and do things, and I've also seen on internet, I search around and look for all kinds of things and forms, and you got the rules of the court that lays out a lot of forms. Any court, you go to the federal, we've got the federal rules right up on our website. They'll give you all the, right in the federal rules, they give you all the forms you need, but there's a lot that they don't tell you. And there's a procedure and a process is that they don't tell you. And they don't tell you what comes first and what comes next. They don't give you any of that information. They want to keep that from the people. I'm surprised the lawyer who put this course together is still alive, to be honest with you. Because this is like top secret. This is like the magician sharing their secrets, or the priest sharing the backroom discussions of what they're really doing,
Well, we're turning into pumpkins because it's after midnight now. And, and I lost my train of thought. Somebody was saying earlier tonight that, we can automate all the processes with the rules of the courts because they have artificial intelligence and you wouldn't have, it would be much easier to write the case if you had it on some kind of program where all those procedures and what to file when would come up automatically. But there's only one problem with automating everything is certain things that the court does, like certain court rules, we don't even follow because we see that they're unconstitutional or they don't apply to us. Like that one case we were in, John, they said, oh, according to Municipal Rule 50, you got to do this and that. And all you did was say, we don't follow that. We're not a municipality. You know what? They never argued with us. They went on to their next bullcrap because they can't. And so we say, no, that's not for us. That's for you. That doesn't apply to us. Read the first page that John was just talking about. And a lot of times, I mean, at least for us, they have never come back and said, oh, no, you have to do it. Never. Right, John?
That's right.
So there you
we,
go.
We don't appeal nothing. We sue directly. That's the power and the authority of a court of record.
Right.
Okay. Once you open up your court of record and you do that with just a couple of words, well, I'm one of the people of New York State or whatever state you're in, and in this court of record, blah, 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 blah. Okay, now you've opened up your court of record. Give it definitions, you know, with footnotes and stuff, and then make your case and your point that this needs to be shut down. You don't have the jurisdiction. My court is bigger than your court. Oh, no, it isn't. And he slaps his gavel down and tells you to come back next Thursday. Well, before next Thursday, you want to serve that judge and let it be known his court case is closed down because you just brought him back into your court case and you're taking it up to the federal court to deal with it because this is a constitutional issue, and that is under the authority of the U.S. Court system, not under some rinky-dink town, village, or city, or whatever it is, you know. And again, you got to be prepared for all this. You know, once you get to figure out how things work and you see the process, read the rules, look at the layouts, and then we can share with you an actual court case which shows you the basic layouts, which we've already got a lot of them up online anyway. You know, we've done memorandums, so when you talk about you know, the jurisdiction, we've got a memorandum on jurisdiction, a memorandum on jurisdiction of law, a memorandum on this, a memorandum on that. We got like 10 or 12 memorandums up there, and you can utilize them, make reference, make your point in your case on whatever it is that you wanted to make the point of. The Article 3, this is an Article 3 court, and see memorandum on Article 3 court attached or whatever. And then you have the case on what an article in the memorandum of law you got what an Article 3 court is, and this is what you're expected to see in this courtroom, and this is how we expect to run it. You see, we're coming in under the Constitution, which is called the law of the land, and we're under the common law. We're not under statutes. You can't control our behavior, and so everything you do in your paper, you want to support it, and the best way to support a position in law is to write a memorandum. Refer to that so you don't, you know, kind of fog up your case. You want to keep your case simple and focused, point by point on what you're dealing with. But if you try to cover everything inside the case, it becomes too much for anyone. It becomes, you know, it gets lost. You lose everything. And it's difficult to do also. But anyway, I think we've come to the end. Are we at the end, Gerard?
We're over the end.
We're over the end. We're over the edge. So I'd like to say to everyone, have a good evening, have a good couple of weeks, and Merry Christmas to everyone. And let's not forget what Christmas is all about. Godspeed. And Gerard?
Yeah.
Back
Ditto.
To you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Dittos. Okay. Good night, everybody. See you in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Jen?